Good morning, everybody. Matt Bubala here with you, 720 WGN. Roger Badish in the newsroom, Jess Rains behind the glass, 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you want to join in the show, be part of it. We've got the lights down in the studio.
Hello, Roger. Oh, my God, I can't even, you're like a little white little spot with the glow of the computers.
Jess, you are just 2 weeks in a row. Is that a fat joke again? What? She just said into my ear, you're like a little bear in a den.
What?
So the fat boy's hibernating? Is that what you're saying? Man, you are just
I didn't say nothing.
A hole every time, Jess.
That's your producer.
I know who it is. Right, start talking on the radio and quit talking in my ear. You want to say these things, you got to say
people want to hear her.
Yes, I know.
Use the microphone.
Yeah, you have a microphone right there. She can't get used to the new producers.
I know.
She actually has a real microphone set up right there for the whole deal.
Yeah, that's funny. Say it again.
Roger?
I'm doing fine.
Yeah?
I'm doing great. A busy week. I've been filling in for Esmeralda for a couple of extra days.
I saw a lot of tweets that you were here in studio and things like that.
Yeah, having a good time and partnering up with my old original partner, Nick DiGilio. My first night, I think, was a Friday or Saturday night back about 11 and a half years ago. And Nick was my first person. My first host, yeah.
So
it's fun. And get to spend time with you this weekend and Jess and everybody.
Sure.
Yeah, this is the highlight.
Good. Excellent.
Of course.
Well, you know, I didn't get to do... If you don't go in studio now, Patty won't talk to you, is what Elliot told me the rule is. So,
oh, is that?
I was here, and they wouldn't do cry if I didn't.
Wait, we can't connect the two studios?
No, I think we can. I think they're just putting the line in the sand.
I got you.
I got to walk down there if I want.
You've got to make an appearance.
I guess so.
Yeah.
So I'll walk the 10 feet next week, I promise. But so I didn't get to do, tell me something good.
Yeah.
You know how there's exactly one parking spot available in front of this building?
Yes, you told me. Yes.
I got it tonight.
No way. How do you like just like hang out there kind of around the corner and wait for someone to clear it out?
I think I got here later than I ever get here. And I don't know if somebody leaves or if it's just really blind luck or what happened. But
that's wild.
Tonight when I leave, boom, out the elevator, in the car, boom.
I have something good.
Okay, well, we'll just continue Patty's show then. Please tell me something good. What's yours, Jess?
Well, I start my new job on Monday, and I get to be here with you and Roger because I love you both so much.
You're starting a new job, and I forget, there's somebody in your life that you called fat last week and tonight who gave you a glowing recommendation for that job.
Notice she waited until after you gave the recommendation.
After she got the job, said person got called fat twice.
Roger and I have a surprise for you.
Is it going to be like, you know what I'm picturing?
Right, Raj?
Yeah.
You know what I'm picturing?
Yes.
This alleged surprise that's coming. Did you ever see, now, Jess wouldn't have seen or
heard
of the
show. It's in the
mail. But Raj, I swear it was like on Laverne and Shirley or something like that, where it was one of those old weight loss machines where it sort of looks like a treadmill, but it's got the band that goes behind you.
Oh, right.
That
kind of shakes you back and forth. Right, right, right.
I'm guessing you guys got me one of those. That would be
close.
Cool,
close.
Roger, should we give him a hint?
Yeah. You have a bunch of these already, but this one is extremely unique and one of a kind.
You guys got me a Star Wars shirt, didn't you? You can tell by Jess's face that that's what it is. All right, well, now I'm very excited. I'm sure it's a triple extra large.
It'll fit on you.
Wait a minute. Can you see me? Can you see me? No. Said, what did you say? Triple extra large?
Yeah.
You can see. Can you see me in the TV?
Sort of, yes.
Yeah, all right. Good. Triple extra large.
Higher. Go higher. You're so lucky you're down there. You better batten down those doors. I'm going to beat you with your red vines.
It'll take you at least 10 minutes to get in through these doors. They're heavy.
Oh, I thought you were going to say you won't fit. Squeeze through. Grease up.
I didn't say it.
Mm-hmm.
By the way,
yes,
pizza coming later.
I'm not buying you any pizza ever again. So there.
Hey, Jess, order a pizza.
Free truck for as long as it's going. Here's what's coming up on the show tonight. After 1:30, all right, there's the craziest story, and I told you guys about this a few months ago. I think it was, maybe not a few months ago, but about a month ago, I saw this story, and I read it to you guys, and then Jess has been trying ever since to get somebody on to tell us what the hell is going on.
Mm-hmm.
In Canada, there is like this weird thing, like for over, I don't know how many years, feet have been washing up on beaches.
Ooh.
Literally a foot with a shoe on it.
Ooh.
Or like the lower half of a leg.
Yeah, yeah.
And they cannot figure out what in the world this is. So we've got a guy who's going to talk about it. He is a world-renowned oceanographer, Kurt Ebbesmeyer.
That's easier for you to say.
Kurt Ebbesmeyer.
Okay.
He's going to jump on the phone with us after the 1:30 news to try and explain ocean currents and why things might be doing it. There's some theories, but they don't exactly know what's going on.
Shark attacks.
I guess it
could. Like in one part and then whatever's left.
No, well, Canada?
Well, but whatever's left from wherever the sharks attack the people, the currents drag it to Canada, maybe.
I don't think they would drag it up north. I mean, this is all in the Vancouver area.
Well.
And I would assume that the sharks are further south, right? Because they're sort of warmer water.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I guess we'll find out about the currents.
Yeah. I'm very interested now.
And I don't think they're coming up with big bite marks, right, Jess? Well, I guess by the time they're getting them, it's a shoe and bones. It's not really
much of a foot. Been washed over by
them. To my understanding, several feet have washed up within a particular region.
Yeah.
And a lot of it has just been like the lower leg with a shoe still attached onto it.
I think they're thinking either people, one of the theories is just people that drown or people that die in the ocean for whatever reason because of the currents. What ends up being left is, you know, the body ends up getting dismantled by, you know, currents, by fish, by whatever. And because a shoe is kind of a hardy thing, it holds onto a piece and carries on, I guess. We'll find out more about it. After the 2:30 news, our old buddy Chris Williamson, he is the host of the Searching for Earhart podcast.
Oh, yeah.
Find out the latest about Amelia Earhart.
Mm-hmm.
And at 4 o'clock in the morning, we're going to chat with our buddy Mark Shipper. We talked to him last week. Remember, he is in Pamplona, Spain, at the San Fermin Festival for the Running of the Bulls. And if you recall, last week, we chatted, because Mark was there last year. That's when we first talked to him about the running, because he was there to help make a documentary. And this year, he just was like, I got to go back. He just fell in love with the whole thing.
Sure.
So he went back. But he hadn't run.
Now, right.
Yeah, and we talked to him last week.
He wasn't planning on it, was he?
He was kind of in between. He's like, I just don't know. Well, we'll find out. Because I think it ends either this morning is the last run or yesterday was. I'm not 100% sure. So we'll find out when we get him on the phone whether or not he finally pulled the trigger and ran.
Boy, I'd like to hear that he did.
Well. You will have to wait and see.
So. Don't.
312-981-7200. By the way, and then we'll just go through a bunch of stories. I have some interesting things to talk about. Chicago's last Sears store. Now, there's still stores in the suburbs, but the last one in the city of Chicago is closing.
Closing Sunday. Well, today will be the last day of sales and closing for good on Sunday. Yeah.
So we'll talk a little bit about that.
Okay.
And just this past week, just on one of those This Day in History things, the anniversary of Alexander Burr and Aaron Burr had their duel,
right,
which killed Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there's a big musical and everything else about Hamilton, but but the story about that is kind of interesting. There's a really long history.com article that I want to go through a little bit too. And we'll take your calls and your texts and all that good stuff. 312-981-7200. Give us a call, jump in, talk about whatever you like. We're here for you all night long till 5 a.m. We had, before I left, Raj, there were some big rainstorms coming through way out in West Dundee and Elgin and those areas. Some big.
Yeah, I've been following those all night.
Is that headed down and
no, those have kind of broken up a bit. There was a really strong string of storms, rain that was embedded within that, and that kind of fell apart a little bit, and it split off, and it's way north right now. North Chicago is its southern end right now. That is heading out over the lake. It's part of a much bigger system, goes all the way up through Wisconsin. There's another smaller section now that I mentioned before. It's Aurora, Naperville, Warrenville. Schaumburg is its northern end. That is making its way eastward. It's not, it doesn't have very many strong parts to it. It's just kind of a steady rain. But then behind that, there's another series of storms. And we're expecting rain throughout today and tonight, Saturday night, and into Sunday morning. Again, if people want to keep up to date, the best way, if you like checking out maps and following the storms, I would recommend the WGN-TV Interactive Weather Radar page. You can get it on your cell phone. You can do it on your cell phone. You can do it online on your computer. But watch that, and that's an extremely accurate way of following these storms. But we shouldn't have much for the next couple of hours. It'll be kind of light, and that section, the north should get out of it and be clear. It'll be the central section of the Chicago area and the southern portion that'll be covered. So we'll keep an eye on it for you.
We're supposed to have baseball day tomorrow, and it just looks like, ugh, we're not
going
to.
Well, I don't know. I mean, where are you going to be playing?
In West Dundee.
Like,
according to, like, weather.com, my little weather app that I do, we have, like, a 50% chance of rain every hour of the day tomorrow.
Right.
So you never know. It's hit or miss.
Yeah, exactly.
But it looks like if you were planning on spending the day outdoors, getting work done tomorrow, it might not happen how you would like.
And, of course, I was thinking yesterday, you know, I haven't washed my car in a long time.
So you got that done.
Yeah,
and brought the rain right in for us.
Yeah, it looks great after a rain.
You know what's funny, Raj, is I was just thinking earlier today, because I know we've talked about this year. This was the wettest May on record,
mm-hmm.
and June started out pretty wet. April was brutal.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had a ton of rain. I mean, the grass was very green out by all the houses by us. And just today or yesterday, I'm driving down our street, and I'm looking, how many of these lawns now are getting that tint of brown?
Yeah.
And it's like, God, we had nothing but rain forever, and now it's funny how it turns. You know, you get to these times, and out at the ball fields, they're like beaches now. The sand is all cracked, and it's, you know, we had so many games canceled, now it's just a sandstorm out there. And it's funny how quick it changes. So the rain, it's funny, as high as the river is, the grass is getting brown again. So the rain isn't the worst thing in the world for those of us that have lawns to maintain.
Yeah, it's it'll get some moisture over the next 24 hours, and that'll be nice. But then again, you know, it's I heard a report yesterday that the entire country, the temperatures have been, on average, higher than normal. And even though you said we had a wet spring, that the rain has kind of stayed away, and we're really seeing some dryouts in a lot of parts of the country right now. So
yeah, well, you know, believing it or not, the science of global climate change says we're going to just. It doesn't mean it's the globe is warming or that it's cooling or whatever. It means
we're going through phases.
Things are going to fluctuate. Yeah. Quite a bit. And so we'll get those huge snowstorms or summer or winters without any snow. We'll get tons of rain or not get rain at all. It's just going to be more variations. Hey, guess who's on the phone? Our buddy Wally, the world traveler.
Oh, great.
Oh, Jess is talking. Jess and Wally have this great relationship. She's going to talk to him.
Put him on the...
Maybe he'll talk to us. Maybe Jess is just going to talk his ear off.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, you do have a radio show, you know?
Oh, now you're turning on you're in cahoots calling me fat, but now you're turning on. I see how you play this, Roger.
I didn't do nothing.
You play both sides. That's what you do. All right, let's just stop here. Let's say hi to Wally real quick. Our friend Wally's on the phone. Hey, Wally, how are you?
Hey, man, I'm doing okay. How are you?
I'm good. Where are you at these days, sir?
Yeah, so I'm actually home this weekend. I was in Seattle and San Francisco this past week, and I'll be gone again next week, but I'm home this weekend. You may have heard about that 27-year-old girl that was shot and killed in Mexico last week.
Now, I'm trying to remember. I do remember the story. Was that in Mexico City?
It was in Mexico City, yeah. It was actually a good part of the city, but she was there with her husband. They were celebrating their one-year anniversary, and she was walking out of the restaurant, and her husband was right behind her, and some guy, I guess, came up on a motorcycle and started firing some shots at somebody who was in the restaurant, and she just worked. Terrible place at the wrong time, and so she was killed. So we had a wake tonight, and the funeral's tomorrow. But there were a couple hundred people at the wake, at least, and just a huge, very, very popular and great family.
I'm so sorry to hear that, Wally. That's terrible. Yep. It's a terrible, senseless tragedy, and terrible for Mexico because Mexico just has a rough reputation right now with crime in Cancun area, and of course. In certain areas where there's drug cartel issues, do we know, was this like a cartel shooting, something like that?
I don't know that they really know. It sounds like it was just some guys who were out for some other guy and just, you know, shooting at into the restaurant. I mean, just senseless. I don't know any more than that, man. I really don't know more of the details. But yeah, it's, you know, I guess the bottom line is just, you know, people that you love and people that that are close to you, just make sure you let them know how how much they mean to you. And you know, I'm sorry not to be a downer, but you know, just let people know, you know, that they're special, and hug them, and you know, share your thoughts with them, and keep them close if you can.
How is her husband doing? I can't imagine. I can't imagine what he's going through.
Incredible, yeah. He spoke tonight at the wake, just, you know, thanking everyone, and they were married a year. July 1st last year, we were at their wedding. And, yeah, so just a terrible, senseless thing. But it's, her parents are, you know, I mean, obviously, it's incredible just to have something like this happen. But her parents are... wonderful people, and she's got a younger sister, and just great people, and just there's no animosity, just, you know, just a senseless act. So
I don't know, you know, it's I know people who've lost children at young ages, and I don't know a lot of families who've lost young kids like this, but I just don't know how they find the strength to go on. I can't imagine for all of us with all the problems we have in our everyday lives, and not to dismiss our problems in everyday life, they can weigh us down very greatly, and sometimes we have huge problems in our lives, sometimes they're small problems that get to us, but then you hear about something like this and you realize how blessed you are in your own life, and no matter pretty much what you got going on, unless you have that going on, things are pretty good. And
it's
a terrible way to have to be reminded of that, but I'm glad you were able to be in town for the family, Wally, and be able to attend and pay your respects.
Yep. Thank you. Thank you, Matt. Yep. So show sounds good. And I will be traveling, and I will call in. I'm just right now not in a string where I need to be going over the weekends. But I know I will be in the next few months. So I'll keep calling in and keep listening to you, whether I'm at home or somewhere around the world.
Well, that sounds good. You know, Jess and I were talking off the air one of these weeks. I said, you know, when Wally's at home, he's probably listening because he can't get it. You probably can never get on a normal clock, can you? Because when you're home for a few days or a week, but you're always in some other time zone. Are you really screwed up when you first come back home? Is it hard to get back on a central time zone?
Yeah, you know, I guess the good news, bad news is typically when I'm traveling, you know, hours, I'm usually up by 6 and going to bed around midnight, 1 o'clock, regardless of where I am. So it's just a little bit messed up anyway. And I was in Seattle and San Francisco, so I landed this morning around 5 o'clock from San Francisco. So yeah, a little bit messed up.
I'll bet. All right. We'll get some sleep, and we'll talk to you next time you travel. And then we'll have to plan down the road sometime when you're in town for you to come in and show us some photos.
Love to, Matt. Yep, love to. The show sounds great. Have a great show.
All right, thanks, Wally. You have a good one. Thank you so much.
All right, thanks.
Bye-bye. All right, unfortunately, rough news from Wally there, but glad he's in town and able to attend to it. And it does remind you, you know, make sure you hug the ones that you love. All right, we're going to take a quick break, do the news, coming up next on 720 WGN. Right now, it is 1:30 in the morning. Let's check the news headlines. Roger Battish. It's the Matt Lavalla Show here on 720 WGN. We're live from the Allstate Showcase Studios. Actually, we're the Allstate Skyline Studios now, from the 18th floor of 303 East Wacker in our new home here for WGN Radio. Thanks so much for staying up late with us, everybody. Whether you're working, hanging out, just can't sleep, whatever it is, 312-981-7200 is the phone number. It's also the text line, so give us a call. Jump on in if you want to. Here is our very interesting story of the weekend. We saw this a month or two ago, but here's a little bit of the story. This was from the New York Times. Back in May, it said the mystery has haunted Canadians for more than a decade. One by one, human feet clad in running shoes have floated ashore on British Columbia's southern coast with gruesome regularity. Last weekend, I remember this was back in May, foot number 14 was discovered by a man strolling on a beach on Gabriola Island, a sleepy and picturesque enclave, population 4,000, that is known for its captivating sandstone and close-knit artistic community. This time, the foot squeezed between a pile of logs wore what appeared to be a hiking boot, according to the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. The 13 feet found previously along the coast since 2007 were in running shoes, Adidas, Reebok, and other brands. Each time the question arose, why are the feet ending up in Canada? Where did they come from? And where are the other parts? And that is the unknown. The discoveries have fanned speculation, rational or not, that the unattached feet could be the work of a tsunami, a human trafficker, a mafia hitman, a deranged foot fetishist, or a serial killer who had spread body parts out to sea. Others have theorized that the floating appendages could belong to people falling off a ship or killed in a plane crash. So what in the world is going on? A man who might have a theory that could shed a little light on this for us is Curtis Ebsmeyer. He's a world-renowned oceanographer and a beachcomber, and he joins us on the phone right now. Good morning, Kurt. How are you doing?
Matt, that's a nice intro piece you have.
Oh, well, thank you. It's a weird story, though. I imagine to you it's not that weird, though, because I've read that you said long ago that, you know, the ocean is vastly unknown, that we really don't understand currents and where things end up and how things get in the ocean in the first place. Have you been looking at this type of phenomena, maybe not feet and shoes, but how the ocean currents work and where things end up for a while?
Yeah, I've been looking at it for, like, I don't know, 30 years.
And would you say that in general, when we get surprised by things, we shouldn't be so surprised because that's kind of how currents work?
Well, I think the surprise part comes from the fact that we know so little. If we understood what's really going on, it's no surprise at all. The feet are a good example, and every time I walk a beach in Florida, I find about a shoe every mile, and I collect and I count lefts and rights, and it turns out that certain beaches have an affinity for lefts and other beaches have an affinity for rights. So that's a pretty formidable question.
Wait, what do you mean? What do you mean certain beaches have lefts and certain have rights? You mean feet that wash up on the shore?
These are shoes. These are footwear.
Just that people leave behind or that you think wash up?
Well, they just wash up. And there's no, these don't have any feet in them. They just wash up. And the question is, how come there's more lefts on one beach and more rights on the other beach? And it turns out that that's the way the winds and the currents face the footwear. So it's a natural phenomenon.
Now, wait a minute. Kurt, you've got to explain that to me. I don't understand how the currents are deciding.
Okay.
Lefts, you go that
off,
way. Rights, you stay
take
over
off
here.
Your shoes and put them in a bathtub.
Okay.
And then put a fan on them and turn them over so that the fan, you'll find that the fan can't blow in the same orientation on each shoe. So the ocean's winds wind up sorting out as the footwear drifts along, it sorts it out into rights and lefts.
Are you serious? And because of the curve in the shoe?
Yeah, every pair of shoes. Just take off your shoes and look at them while we're talking, and you'll see that if you turn them over as they're look like they're drifting, you can't orient them to the wind in the same way. So it's a natural thing, and you say, well, why in the world would Mother Nature want to have a left and a right in the first place? And it turns out that lots of very primitive sea creatures have left and right differences, and it helps them spread out and increases their chances of survival.
Okay, now you're really blowing me away. But let's go back to the shoes just for a minute, because you still got to explain this to
me.
So that the reason that the ocean is sending a left one way and a right the other way is because of the shape of the shoe, correct? Just the curve of the insole?
It's the shape of the shoe with respect to the wind.
And how the wind affects it. So it'll affect a right different than a left.
Yeah, it's you can actually go and do it yourself. You can count shoes yourself. Very often you'll find this. Now, when you start getting into something a little more esoteric, like a real foot in a shoe, you say, well, how does this happen? And it turns out that it's also a very natural process. If you happen to throw a body in the water and watch it for a while,
which you have not done, Kurt, we're just going to be clear, right?
I have not done that.
Okay,
but other people have. You've heard of the body farm. I think it's in Kentucky, where they put bodies out on the soil in various environmental conditions, and they watch what happens over time.
Kurt, I have not heard of the body farm. What in the world is that? Are those like with cadavers?
Yeah, it's a very necessary thing to know when you're investigating crime, how a body comes apart.
And so how a body breaks down, so that when they find a body that maybe they got to figure out how long has it been out in the elements
exactly.
And things like that?
Wow. Yeah, it's not unusual to find a body that's been out for years. But you need to know pretty closely how many days, and thus you have the body farm.
So there's literally a body farm in Kentucky where they get cadavers and they put them out in various states of dress and undress, I imagine, and then let them sit through the elements and they measure how everything decomposes and what happens.
Exactly. There's hundreds and hundreds of bodies out there.
Oh, my gosh. Seriously?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I had a computer to Google body farm.
I don't know that I want to do that. Oh, my gosh, Kurt. And what do, FBI agents, forensic agents, people like that go here and, like, probably do work and, like, learn how to do this stuff, I imagine?
Yeah, you have experts going out there, and they very carefully take apart a body that's been out there for various lengths of time, and they see what's happening. It's like other experts look at the insects in a body.
Yeah.
It turns out that the insects will lay their eggs and go through various life stages in a very predictable sequence, and that's often used to determine time of death.
Kurt, I'm getting a lot more out of this than I expected. I got to tell you that. I'm learning stuff that I never would have picked up on an episode of CSI, I'm guessing. Well, that is fascinating.
I think what's going on here, we don't have a body farm for drifting bodies.
Maybe they need that. Well, so I was reading some things you've said, and with this foot thing that's floating up in Canada, you've talked about a Nike phenomenon where once Nike invented these certain soles, that maybe that has changed how things float and stay alive in the ocean, right? Or keep floating. Is that part of what could be happening here?
Nike invented, remember the Air Jordans?
Sure.
They invented a gas that they could put into the sole of a shoe to make it more springy.
And thus
the Air Jordan.
Okay, and so that's, and I'm sure everybody copied that. So the reason maybe that so many of these are floating up in running shoes is because if a body ends up in the ocean and eventually it decomposes, things happen, fish, wear and tear, whatever. So limbs, I guess, would start separating as decomposition happens. But these shoes are likely to stay floating, so eventually whatever remained with the shoe would end up on an island somewhere?
That's exactly right. You put it very well. And the trouble, I worked with Nike, and I still do whenever there's a container spill of Nike shoes, because every shoe has a serial number, and I use it to track the ocean currents. That's how I got into the floating world, was Nike told me the code, and they had lost 80,000 shoes back in 1990, and they told me the code. And that was the largest spill of numbered objects ever undertaken in oceanography. So I started looking at container spills.
Well, that's interesting, and to see where that stuff ends up at. So you measure from where it spilled and then see where pieces start floating to shore, and that way you can track how the current worked?
Exactly. And so time went on, and I started working with medical examiners, and they would say, here's where the body wound up. How did the currents take it there? And I wrote, scientific journal articles on how bodies drifted in the water, and that was a first. So I said, well, okay, how does this really work? And the medical examiners would tell me that human bodies, when they come apart, usually disarticulate, which means they come apart at the joints. So you put it very well about the sneakers. You look at your feet and you say, well, where's the big joint? And that would be the ankle. And the foot just fits in the shoe. And when it decomposing goings on, the gases, it caused the foot to expand and wedge itself in the shoe. So when the foot comes off, all you really have left on a body is the foot in a shoe, because there isn't any other flotation device that we usually wear.
That's so fascinating. Now, I read that you've said, so the tsunami in Japan, that was how many years ago now?
2003. So it's been a while, but I was expecting, given all the the tens of thousands of people that were lost, I was expecting feet in sneakers. And so I urge people, if you see a sneaker on the beach and you see bones in it, do not leave it, because the ocean will take it away.
Mm-hmm.
And that may be the only remains that a family has of a loved one. So One thing about the ocean is if you see it on the beach, it's like, and you try to come back and find it again, it's likely not to be there because the ocean's always moving things around.
And so, but feet have never really started washing up from the tsunami like you expected, right? And now it's
not that I have reported to me. I just, so I'm still puzzled by that. I would guess it happened, but it's not unusual for, if you watch the news very carefully, it's not unusual for feet to wash up in shoes.
Well, and I imagine we don't hear about that much in Chicago because we're not on any of the coasts, where I guess it would happen more often probably, right? Why do we not hear about that here off Lake Michigan?
I would guess that quite a few wash around Lake Michigan. It's just the police don't like to report it because there's a lot of
freaks people out.
ghoulish people out there that the police don't want to be bothered by people who really don't know anything. So I would guess Lake Michigan has quite a few.
How many bodies do you estimate are floating in the oceans of the world at any one time?
No, well, let's see. Let's go back to British Columbia. I was doing some work there, and I learned that there's about, back 10 years ago, there was 2,400 people officially listed as missing. So you say, well, where are they? Well, some are going to be in the water, and some of those are going to be feet that wash up. So that's, you're talking about a lot of missing people.
Well,
and most of those missing people are not criminals, so they aren't in the DNA databases.
Let's talk about, so now here's something that's fascinated me for, I think, 5 years now. MH370, the Malaysian Airlines plane that disappeared over radar and we believe flew until it ran out of gas and crashed in the ocean somewhere off of Australia. And the search actually was finally officially concluded. There was reports about a year ago about finding a couple of plane parts, but then nothing more ever happened. How is that possible?
Well, if you, I tracked the MH370 by, I had five reports of different parts of the aircraft. They were all on the right-hand side of the plane. I have not seen a detailed forensic analysis of those plane parts. But when you laid them out on a map of currents across the Indian Ocean, they followed a very predictable pattern, of well-known pattern of currents that run from off Australia over to South Africa. And so the five pieces of the aircraft were distributed roughly across the Indian Ocean in a very, very, very predictable way. And the last piece that was reported was in South Africa. And lots of objects have been released to steady currents off South Africa, and in about 2 years, quite a few of them have arrived up in Florida. I'm expecting MH370 parts in Florida.
Really? But why haven't we seen any body parts? Why aren't there any shoes?
Well, that's a good question. Now, if you subscribe to the theory that the plane went down in deep water like 15,000 feet, which would be a typical depth in the Indian Ocean, what happens is when something goes to that depth, it gets compressed into a very solid object. I have mannequin heads that have been lowered down 15,000 feet. In fact, I'm looking at one right here as we speak. That was brought back. And it's about 2 inches tall. Originally, it was a wig head that was about a foot tall, but it's rock solid. So
because it got crushed down by the pressure?
Yeah, by the pressure just makes it rock solid. Now, I wouldn't be surprised if the MH370, if it went down in that kind of pressure, shoes would have been compressed from a foot long. No pun intended, just a foot long, they would have been compressed down to about an inch or two long and may not have float. So when you put that kind of pressure on an object, it changes the density of that object and its ability to float. So I don't think we know the answer to that.
So for that to happen, our assumption would have to be the plane somewhat stayed together then. It didn't, disintegrate as it hit the ocean, because then bodies would have been scattered everywhere and they wouldn't have necessarily floated down. With your theory there, we're assuming the plane stayed mostly intact and then floated down you know,
well,
sunk down.
I kind of wonder about
right?
that because the parts of the plane came from the right side, and it suggests that the plane came apart to a certain extent. I don't think we're going to know, but the behavior of human bodies in the water, particularly at high pressure, I think is virtually unknown.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's fascinating. So are you surprised that more of the plane hasn't washed up then?
Yeah, I am. I'm really very surprised because the pieces that have been reported are kind of, you know, fairly large. But I haven't seen a detailed forensic analysis of those pieces. So I think there's a lot more to be learned, and I'm sure the investigators continue to puzzle over those pieces. So you might recall back to the Titanic, how long it took just to find the wreckage from the Titanic. That was 1912.
Well, but we didn't have the technology that we have now. I mean, I understand it is a vast ocean. We're not, you know, we probably can't truly grasp how big of an area we're really talking about the search being and the depth of the water there, right?
Exactly. I've watched, you know, like we all did, a lot of the searches going on, and it's such a vast ocean. I've spent 4 years in the ocean just looking for things, and it's really, really so. It's almost beyond comprehension how big the ocean is. I mean, you sit in a media studio and look at film, you just don't get the feeling if you're actually out there looking for things, it is really, really tough.
Yeah, I can imagine. Kurt Ebsmeyer is a world-renowned oceanographer and a beachcomber. When they say you're a beachcomber, do you just love walking on beaches all over the world, or are you always looking to see what washed up on shore?
No, I beachcomb the internet. I have a newsletter. I wrote a book, and I continue. People are always telling me, "Kurt, you know about this?" And the answer is usually no. There's so much to be learned. So I encourage people to email me with things they see, questions they have, because there's really no stupid question. Just questions are just. Almost every question will lead to a PhD after just a few sentences of thought.
Huh. So, Kurt, well, how can people find you on the internet? Where should they go?
If you want to find me, just go just Google my name, Ebsmeyer, Ebsmeyer, and you can find me at The Floating World. And there's a book there on The Floating World, and I wrote about everything from pharaohs to Vikings to how Columbus really did discover America with flotsam and things like that.
Interesting. Is the book called The Floating World?
It's called Flotsametrics. It's a new word I invented. F-L-O-T-S-A metrics. Flotsam metrics. And I figured we needed a word for the face of the ocean because it turns out that it's virtually unexplored.
Yeah.
It's, you know, economics is not the only dismal science. I would put oceanography there, too.
Kurt Ebsmeyer, the author of Flotsametrics, and that's available online. And search him, Google him, and you can find more. Kurt, we'll check in with you again. We really appreciate your time tonight.
Well, thanks, Matt. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Thank you. We'll talk to you again. Well, that is interesting. Flotsametrics. Flotsametrics. That's a new word for you. All right, let's take a quick break. We'll do the news coming up here in a little bit. Matt Bubala with you on 720 WGN. Got your Sox baseball today. You got your Cubs won last night. Javi Baez stealing second. Throw goes in the outfield. Comes all the way around to score. Cubs hold on in extra innings for the win. And
he is exciting.
He is exciting. I do not like him in that home run derby. We'll talk about that later. By the way, Kurt Ebsmeyer is the guy. If you want to, look up online, Kurt, and you know, he mentioned this Body Farm. Mm-hmm. Somebody texted. Let's see who texted. 615 texted. The Body Farm is part of the Department of Anthropology at the University of Tennessee. 773 texts that SIU also has a Body Farm. 309 says, intriguing guest. I really enjoyed him sharing his knowledge and experience in that. So thank you very much for that. The fascinating thing is he mentioned the Body Farm. I believe that that's where Stormy Daniels got arrested in Ohio last night, wasn't it?
Oh, the name of the strip club?
No, it wasn't. It was a funny thing. I
Wow. I was just wondering, on the Bobby farm, do they let them out to pasture during the day? What do they feed them down there on the farm? How do you keep them on the farm?
Do you have any more,
after
Roger?
They've seen Perry? Oh, huh?
Where's Orion to slap?
I wonder how many square feet each part gets.
Orion, come in here and slap Roger, please. The Steve Cochran Show celebrates the most valuable person on the planet. Funny enough, his name is not Roger. Weekday mornings at 720 on 720 WGN Chicago. Smart speaker users just say, play WGN Radio on TuneIn. Let's check those headlines and more with Roger Badish. This is gonna be the best day of my life. Matt Bobala here with you, 720 WGN, 210 in the morning. We're in the Allstate Skyline Studios. That was Roger Badish with the news. If you call 312-981-7200, you can say hello to Jess as she answers the phones and keeps us on time. Roger?
Yes?
Since you were making a lot of bad jokes earlier?
I sent my sinuses to Arizona. I sent my liver to Peru. I sent my lungs and my kidneys for the summer to Sydney, but I'm sending my heart to you. Body Parts. It's an old song. I'm sorry. You were saying?
No, it's a perfect setup because my brother just texted
uh-oh,
and said Roger will not be on Cochran's funny list. Because that humor was Badish.
Oh, I get it. Now cut that out.
Right back over there.
Thank you.
Speaking of killing.
Yes.
We had the anniversary this week of the Burr-Hamilton duel.
Ooh.
So I found this on history.com. Now, I have not gone to see Hamilton, the musical.
I can't even afford to think of going to see it.
I know. That's ridiculous. Yes. How many years has the damn thing been out?
I'm waiting for the movie version.
How are there not two for ones by now? Isn't it still like $400? A new block of tickets for the show that's been out for 15 years.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, what the heck? Why are we still going so... Can we all just see the damn thing and get it over with?
Yeah. There was a documentary about it on, I saw it on Amazon Prime. I don't know who did it. I don't know who produced it. But they talked about the production and teased you with like 30 seconds of a song.
Well, they're not going to show the whole thing.
No.
When people are spending $400. But,
exactly. Exactly.
I wouldn't either.
Yeah.
But it's just insane.
Yeah.
How are people
still? And I know people who have seen it 2, 3, 4 times already. I'm like, who do you know, or can I float alone?
Yeah, why are you spending so much money on
it? I don't know.
I guess we all have our things. And I love going to see a musical. I love going to see shows.
Mm-hmm.
I love spending that kind of money. It would make sense to me if it was like only on Broadway. But this is in Chicago for multiple years now.
Yeah. Well,
I wonder how many
people in Chicago got money.
How many different cities is it playing in?
I don't know right now. I could look it up. Or Jess could look it up.
Jess, would you look that up? Give the librarian the night off?
Yes, thank you.
Find out for us, how many cities is that playing in, Jess? And I wonder if in every city the damn thing is in, if it's just as insane.
I would imagine so. I mean, don't think it's in a small city yet.
Because if it's in, like, say, Los Angeles, and they're like, yeah, it's here, but we're not, you know, we're buying tickets, but it's not, you know, we're not jacking them up to $400. I wonder, you know, for some, it might be cheaper to fly to L.A. to go see it there than to see it here.
That's true.
Literally. So anyway, so I haven't seen it yet. I don't know the Alexander Hamilton story. The most I know of these songs is literally from watching Lin-Manuel host Saturday Night Live. He did a takeoff on one of the songs there.
Oh, really?
My daughter knows the songs, Anna, because they were part of a dance recital they did.
Oh.
She really wants to go see the show. And I was thinking, because their birthday's coming up, the triplets, I was thinking, well, maybe I just her and I go. Because I'm not buying tickets for the whole family.
Right.
But I was thinking, well, maybe I get tickets and her and I go.
Sure.
But I have not pulled that.
Then you can go home and reenact it for everyone else.
Jess says it's going to be in 9 cities by the end of the year. All right, search Jess while you're there. Try to see if we wanted to buy a pair of tickets coming up in the next month, if it's possible to even do that for over $100 each.
And here in Chicago?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Around $100. See if If it's, just see the outrageousness. And then when you come back, turn on your microphone and talk to us instead of
the announcing microphone, not the intercom microphone.
That one doesn't work. All right, so here we are. History.com, 1804. In a duel held in Weehawken, New Jersey. Is that why Weehawken is famous? Or no, is that also where...
Something else happened there, didn't
it? No, the blimp, right? Is that where... God, what the hell? I don't know. I not remember the name of that thing.
All right, I guess I got to go to work.
No, don't you dare look that up. You have to know. What's the name of the blimp that crashed? It's the most famous radio broadcast in history.
Stop now. See, you keep talking to me and I can't think.
Oh, the humanity. The,
I know, I know, I know, I know, I know the broadcast. It's
it was a Zeppelin and it was called the Hindenburg. Was that in Weehawken?
Yeah, no. Was it?
Or was it in Lake Amherst?
It wasn't Weehawken.
Where was it?
No, it wasn't Weehawken. It was in New Jersey.
That's Weehawken.
Well,
in New Jersey. I want to say it's in Lake Amherst. I don't know why. That's sticking in my head.
Weehawken, New Jersey. History.
Why aren't you just looking up Hindenburg?
I should look that up because it didn't pop up.
Hindenburg?
It's like it's, you know how it always, it'll be a famous event or something. Yeah. Weehawken is famous for, and no,
what's,
nothing.
What is it famous for?
A lot of American Revolutionary stuff.
Don't you feel like when somebody says Weehawken, you've heard of Weehawken?
It was used as a lookout for the Patriots to check on the British.
So maybe it's just like revolutionary history we hear about Weehawken?
I think so.
The Battle of Weehawken?
Mm-hmm.
219, ding, 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 Lyndhurst, New Jersey.
For the Hindenburg?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. I wonder where Lyndhurst is compared to Weehawken.
Well.
I'll get a map out. You go ahead.
Yes. We'll do two things at once.
Thank you.
In a duel held in Weehawken, New Jersey, Vice President Aaron Burr fatally shoots his longtime political antagonist, Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton, a leading Federalist and the chief architect of America's political economy, dies the following day. Alexander Hamilton, born on the Caribbean island of Nevis, came to the American colonies in 1773 as a poor immigrant. There is some controversy as to the year of his birth, but it was either 1755 or 57. In 1776, he joined the Continental Army in the American Revolution, and his relentless energy and remarkable intelligence brought him to the attention of General George Washington, who took him on as an aide. 10 years later, Hamilton served as a delegate to the Constitutional Convention, and he led the fight to win ratification of the final document, which created the kind of strong, centralized government that he favored. In 1789, he was appointed the first Secretary of the Treasury by President Washington, and during the next 6 years, he crafted a sophisticated monetary policy that saved the young U.S. government from collapse. With the emergence of political parties, Hamilton was regarded as a leader of the Federalists. Aaron Burr, born into a prestigious New Jersey family in 1756, was also intellectually gifted, and he graduated from the College of New Jersey, which is now known as Princeton, at the age of 17. He joined the Continental Army in 1775 and distinguished himself during the Patriot attack on Quebec. A masterful politician, he was elected to the new state assembly in 1783, later served as state attorney. In 1790, he defeated Alexander Hamilton's father-in-law in a race for the U.S. Senate. Hamilton came to detest Burr, whom he regarded as a dangerous opportunist, and he often spoke ill of him. When Burr ran for the vice presidency in 1796 on Thomas Jefferson's Democratic-Republican ticket, which was the forerunner of the Democratic Party, Hamilton launched a series of public attacks against Burr, stating, quote, "I feel it is a religious duty to oppose his career." John Adams won the presidency, and in 1797, Burr left the Senate and returned to the New York Assembly. In 1800, Jefferson chose Burr again as his running mate. Burr aided the Democratic-Republican ticket by publishing a confidential document that Hamilton had written criticizing his fellow Federalist President John Adams. This caused a rift in the Federalists and helped Jefferson and Burr win the election with 73 electoral votes each. Under the electoral procedure then prevailing, president and vice president were not voted for separately. The candidate who received the most votes was elected president, and the second in line, vice president. The vote then went to the House of Representatives. What at first seemed but an electoral technicality, handing Jefferson victory over his running mate, developed into a major constitutional crisis when Federalists in the lame duck Congress threw their support behind Burr. After a remarkable 35 tie votes, a small group of Federalists changed sides and voted in Jefferson's favor. Alexander Hamilton, who had supported Jefferson as the lesser of two evils, was instrumental in breaking the deadlock. Burr became vice president, but Jefferson grew apart from him, and he did not support Burr's renomination to a second term in 1804. That year, a faction of New York Federalists, who had found their fortunes drastically diminished after the ascendance of Jefferson, sought to enlist the disgruntled Burr into their party and elect him governor. Hamilton campaigned against Burr with great fervor, and Burr lost the Federalist nomination and then, running as an independent for governor, lost the election. In the campaign, Burr's character was savagely attacked by Hamilton and others, and after the election, he resolved to restore his reputation by challenging Hamilton to a duel or an affair of honor, as they were known. Affairs of honor were commonplace in America at the time, and the complex rules governing them usually led to an honorable resolution before any actual firing of weapons. In fact, the outspoken Hamilton had been involved in several affairs of honor in his life, and he had resolved most of them peaceably. No such recourse was found with Burr, however, and on July 11, 1804, the enemies met at 7 a.m. at the dueling grounds near Weehawken, New Jersey. It was the same spot where Hamilton's son had died defending his father's honor in 1801. So I know that we all love Hamilton here, and we're making musicals about him, and he sounds like this great guy, but sounds like a bit of a pistol, doesn't he?
Yes, he does.
Causing problems wherever he goes.
I like how you did that. It sounds like a little bit of a pistol.
Shooting off his mouth, ticking people off.
Mm-hmm.
His own son dies in a duel, defending his dad.
Yeah.
You would think that after that happens, it kind of shakes you, and you may be more, you know, smart about how you are about people and what you say and what you do.
Right. One would think.
But apparently not. I wonder how that's handled in the musical. Don't tell me. Don't ruin it for me.
I don't know the musical.
I'm saying the people.
Oh, sorry.
Can't tell us.
Yeah, don't text.
There are conflicting accounts of what happened next. According to Hamilton's second, his assistant and witness in the duel, Hamilton decided the duel was morally wrong and deliberately fired into the air. Burr's second claimed that Hamilton fired at Burr and missed. What happened next is agreed upon. Burr shot Hamilton in the stomach, and the bullet lodged next to his spine. Hamilton was taken back to New York, and he died the next afternoon. Few affairs of honor actually resulted in deaths, and the nation was outraged by the killing of a man as eminent as Alexander Hamilton. Charged with murder in New York and New Jersey, Burr, still vice president, returned to Washington, D.C., where he finished his term immune from prosecution. In 1805, Burr, thoroughly discredited, concocted a plot with James Wilkinson, who was commander-in-chief of the U.S. Army, to seize the Louisiana Territory and establish an independent empire which Burr presumably would lead. He contacted the British government and unsuccessfully pleaded for assistance in the scheme. Later, when border trouble with Spanish Mexico heated up, Burr and Wilkinson conspired to seize territory in Spanish America for the same purpose. In the fall of 1806, Burr led a group of well-armed colonists toward New Orleans, prompting an immediate U.S. investigation. General Wilkinson, in an effort to save himself, turned against Burr and sent dispatches to Washington accusing Burr of treason. In February 1807, Burr was arrested in Louisiana for treason and sent to Virginia to be tried in a U.S. court. In September, he was acquitted on a technicality. Nevertheless, public opinion condemned him as a traitor, and he fled to Europe. He later returned to private life in New York, the murder charges against him forgotten. He died in 1836. That's pretty fascinating.
It is.
I want a musical about Burr now. He sounds like a bit of a... You know, what's funny is, you know, we always hear about Benedict Arnold, right?
Because
he turned on. But Burr is kind of a Benedict Arnold.
Yeah.
Oh my God, wait.
What?
Is he the reason we have the phrase, he's a Burr on your side?
I don't know.
Or is that just about those little things that stick to your
shoes? I think that's, it's a Burr in your saddle.
Is that how it goes?
Original thing. Yeah, but it, and then it's a Burr in your side. Yeah, but I think it's from the Old West, actually.
That makes sense. But I like this. I think we should say, no, it's Alexander Burr. Or what's his name?
Aaron Burr.
I just read it 8,000 times. Aaron Burr. He's a Burr in your side. Just like the guy that shot Hamilton.
But yeah, but wouldn't it be, he's a burr in your spine because the bullet lodged
well,
next to a
true.
Spine.
Or in
yeah.
your stomach.
Or in your stomach, yeah.
He's a burr in your stomach. Yeah, yeah that doesn't work. This
nah.
Is why, this is why you and I aren't coming up with these things.
Somebody tested it long before us.
That is true. But I do think that this is, it's all pretty
It's fascinating. I love history. You and I are alike. We yeah. love history.
We do. And I'll yeah. tell you what, and I'll bring this up now, that, and I don't know when we have a promo coming up for it, but Thomas Jefferson
yeah.
is played by Clay Jenkinson. John Williams and he have been doing these shows forever. I used to produce the CDs we sold afterwards, mm-hmm. and I've been to a bunch of them. Clay's coming back to town as Thomas Jefferson. I think
it's in August.
It's August 18th.
Yeah.
It's at the Mac. I think they just added a second show. Go to WGNradio.com to find out all the details. I think there's still some tickets available for the second show, but it is so worth it to sit in here because what he does is he comes out as Jefferson.
Yeah.
And Jefferson wrote more letters than anybody like ever as president. So he wrote about, I mean, Clay takes you whatever question you give to him.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's about love, whether it's about politics, whether it's about war, he will recite, well, I wrote blah, 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 blah. He's got something that he wrote. It's
right.
sort of like if you walk in and you see Lou and you think, I'm going to stump Lou. Hey, Lou, you know what my roof is doing, blah, blah, blah. And then Lou turns and goes, well, you got to do this. And then you say, well, Lou, my toilet. And he says, well, you got to do this. And you say, well, Lou, my garage. And he says, Lou Manfredini. I've never heard Lou get asked a question and him go, yeah, I'm not sure. Lou always
Never.
Knows the answer. Yeah. Always. That's how this Jefferson is. Clay knows everything he wrote, and he will answer whatever question you give with something that Jefferson wrote. I said, well, I wrote in blah, blah, blah to so-and-so that war should be blah, blah, blah. And it's really fascinating because we can relate common times to how he maybe thought. And he'll always say, hey, the world is for the living, not the dead, and, mm-hmm. and blah, 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 blah. But here's what I thought at the time. And acknowledging that the world has changed quite a bit, and how could Jefferson really comment on
it? Yeah, but he talks about it as, well, this is how we would have dealt with it back
yeah.
in the day, or this is what was meant after we put out the Constitution.
Yeah.
We discussed
right.
it later and decided that blah, 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 blah. I mean, that he's speaking from factual historical documents.
Right, 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 right. Jess says, by the way, that here in Chicago, the cheapest tickets you could find for me for Hamilton are $195 each.
Correct.
What?
That is for tomorrow's show, if you want to go tomorrow.
What time? Okay, it's a little quick. I'm not ready.
It's
no sleep
night.
For you.
It's at what?
It's not even
2:00
her birthday
tomorrow.
Yet. Okay. Well, I'm not going to that one.
Or on Sunday.
But so around $200 is what you have to spend if you
wow.
want to go.
Wow.
Correct.
Forget it.
But side note, they are doing a show September 27th, which is my birthday, but it's in New York. So by
well,
then,
it's in New York every day, isn't it?
No, this one.
It is in New York.
It's
every day.
It's on Broadway.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Okay. We're playing
on Broadway.
Boom.
No, well, no, actually, July 15th,
you know
so this
song.
Sunday,
I know.
They're playing at it's going to be at CIBC Theater, and then the rest of it is just tours around.
870 says, if you have a burr under your saddle, it means you are jumpy. Maybe it's not burr in your side at all. Maybe I'm just making that up. Maybe I'm conflating two. Combining two. Confusing two.
Jeez, I'm just going to have to do more research for you. I swear to God.
Poor Roger. We just make him work.
By your side. Nope. It's burr under your saddle. Idioms.
Jefferson also has a duel of honor story. He had to participate in one of those once because
oh, yeah?
He took a liking to somebody's wife, I believe.
Ooh.
He fixed it though. He never fired a shot.
Yeah.
He had to apologize. He had to like make a statement. But anyways, John Williams, Thomas Jefferson at the Mac. I believe it's August 18th. They added a second show. Go to WGNradio.com. Find out all the details. If you have a chance to go, if you haven't been before, it is fascinating and well worth it. Let me tell you that. Okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to take a break. Roger's going to do the news. And then our buddy Chris Williamson, searching for Earhart. What's the latest on Amelia Earhart? We'll find out from him coming up next on 720 WGN. Dexter says, it's a thorn in your side. They didn't say idiot, but I'm reading between the lines because how do I not get How do you not correct me, Roger? Of course it's a thorn in your side.
I was going with the Burr theme. Thorn didn't come into the picture.
I guess that.
I was trying to straighten that out.
All right. Where is Amelia Earhart? Have we found any more? Our buddy Chris, who does the Searching for Earhart podcast, will jump on the phone with us right after we check the news. It is 2:32 in the morning. Let's get the headlines, Roger. Matt Bobala with you, 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studios at 303 East Wacker. Thanks so much for hanging out with us in the middle of the night, everybody. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Jump in if you want. Jumping in on the phone right now is our buddy Chris Williamson, the head of the Searching for Earhart podcast and documentary film that's coming out pretty soon. Hey, Chris, how are you?
Hey, Matt, how's it going? Good to be back with you.
Yeah, it's good to chat with you. It's been a long time. We have not found Amelia yet. We would have talked to you sooner, but we're still working
not yet
on that. And you've got, we've talked many times over the last few years, you've been working on a documentary, and I understand there's an Amelia Earhart Festival going on coming up this week, and we're going to be premiering the trailer for the first time. Is that true?
Yeah, you know, this is it. We have arrived. I know, as you mentioned, we've been talking off and on for actually last year. We were actually in this position right before the Amelia Earhart Festival, and we were going to be out there shooting a lot of different folks for the documentary. And now we are here a year later in Atchison, about a week out from the festival, and we are premiering, where we're premiering our trailer for it. So it's been an exciting, you know, past 365 days for us.
Why is the festival in Atchison, Kansas? Is that her birthplace?
Yeah, so that's her birthplace. She, you know, she was born and raised in Atchison, Kansas. She's sort of kind of Atchison's girl, and then every year they put on this festival. This is the 22nd annual one, and it's kind of a gathering spot for Amelia Earhart sort of experts and fans and people alike, and we like to say it's sort of Mecca for Amelia Earhart because they have so much stuff going on in Atchison for this particular event, and especially this year. This is going to be the biggest year they've ever had in the last 22 years because of all the people that we have coming in.
Very cool. Okay, let's go through a couple of, let's do some myth busting right now, see where we're at with the whole Amelia
sure.
Research. I was just looking up your podcast, and I found a story from USA Today from a year ago, and the headline was, Bone-Sniffing Dogs Will Search for Amelia Earhart's Remains on Remote Island. Whatever happened with that? Did they go? Did they search and they find nothing?
So they actually did go. National Geographic tagged along. This is, you're referring to the Tiger Group, which is the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery. They've been working the island of Nikumaroro now for a little over 30 years. And this was their latest expedition this last summer out to the island. And they did bring the dogs. They did search several sections of the island. One specific section that's known as the Seven Site, which is what they've been kind of excavating off and on for the last several trips now. And the forensic canines actually did alert to some areas where they indicated that there were remains of bodies that were buried in those specific areas. So they did actually alert to those areas as far as were those bodies Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan. That's still sort of being worked out along with some of the soil samples that they actually been taken from the island. They're actually in the lab right now, and they've been actually working on a lot of lab work for the last year. So those dogs, they did bring them out. It was kind of a new form of technology for Tiger to work out. And it was, according to them, very successful. They did, they did alert to spots where Tiger had indicated that there were bodies. So it's kind of just one of those things where the dogs themselves were just kind of a further confirmation on some of Tiger's work and on an island off and on for the last 30 years. And now it's kind of morphed into a lab setting for them. So now they've got all their samples, all of their information that they've gathered, not only on that particular trip, but other subsequent trips. And now they're kind of working out stuff in lab before they go back to the island. So that's really all we know at this point. They did alert to certain areas. They did alert to areas that they thought they'd find some stuff. And that's kind of where we stand with Tiger right now. So they're putting out a lot of different things. They've been really busy over the last year between that and the Dr. Richard Jantz report that came out and kind of, again, set the world on fire like it tends to do with the Earhart stuff. So it's been busy. It's been a busy year for Tiger.
All right, let's get back to that report in a second. But when they say bodies were buried here, does that make sense to you for that to even be part of Amelia? Because, correct me if I'm wrong, but the theory of this island is they crashed there or landed there because it was something they could land on, then would have been...
Sure.
deserted there for as long as they were able to survive. So there wouldn't have been any burying of bodies most likely there, correct?
Yeah, so really it's just sort of, you know, building a case for them. They've, you know, Tiger has sort of built a case of circumstantial evidence over the course of the last 30 years. So building a case is like building a house, and that's kind of what they've been doing for the last 30 years. Brick by brick, they've been building this case, and there were no bodies buried there that we know of, especially when it comes to Amelia and Fred. The idea there is that they, you know, they landed, as you said, on that island. They survived for a time. They tried to send out radio distress calls, and they eventually succumbed, whether it was because of lack of water or lack of food or just, you know, whatever the case was, they essentially succumbed to the island castaway life. And that's kind of where they ended up. And there's been a lot of sort of rumor and innuendo as on, you know, regarding, you know, how they were disposed of. Were they eaten by crabs, the remains? Were they, you know, was it just kind of one of the things that they just dissipated over time? We don't really know, but they have a lot of interesting aspects of when it comes to areas of the island that they think they might have camped out at and might have, you know, survived for a time at. And that's where they think they maybe would have succumbed eventually, maybe most likely to water, a lack of water, I should say. And that's where the dogs, you know, alerted to in those general areas. You know, they had a couple of hot spots that they thought, well, maybe this could have been, you know, where a body was. And sure enough, the dogs have indicated that there was a body there at one point. So it's kind of an interesting, you know, clue, or an interesting really kind of notch in their belt. But it's really just a notch in their belt. It's nothing hard. Hardcore, yeah. More circumstantial evidence, really.
And for
evidence nonetheless.
For people that aren't as familiar with the story, you're thinking, well, if the plane landed there, where's the plane? But the theory is that this is a little atoll that kind of gets covered by water at times, and where they would have landed, eventually the water would have sucked that plane out to sea, and it would have floated away or sank and kind of rolled down in the sea, right?
Correct, yeah, that it basically broke up and rolled down, you know, it kind of lays off the shores of Nicomoro Island at some point, and it could have been carried out to sea a little ways, but yeah, they've also done a lot of underwater searches. It's sort of really interesting to see how much underwater search plays into the varying hypotheses and the disappearance, and of course, whether it's out in, you know, in deep sea off the shores of Howland, 18,000 plus feet down, or whether it's off the shores of Nicomoro. Yeah, that's one of those aspects that they think it might have broke up and just kind of fell over the atoll and just went underwater. And it's not, most likely, if it's in that position in that area, it is not intact. Whereas if you look at the crash and sink hypothesis, which is what's, you know, sort of supported by the U.S. government at this point, that the plane might relatively be intact due to the state of the water and the underwater environment, it could very well be intact at the bottom of the ocean. So one, broken up, two, maybe intact, depending on where you go.
Okay, the two things that I recall in the last year that have come out that have made headlines a little bit. One is, we know that bones were found on the island, right, many years ago, like in the 40s, right?
Right, and 1940, correct.
And the bones have since disappeared, but measurements were taken. And at the time, they were dismissed as being Amelia Earhart's bones because of the length of, what was it, the bone that goes from our elbow to our wrist, or what bone were they measuring?
Yeah, they were essentially, you know, they were dismissed as being any, you know, female bones of any kind of nature because of the length of some of the bones, based off of the, you know, the actual size of people at the time. They were basically always thought to be that of a man, of Eastern, you know, an Eastern Islander descent or something along the lines of that. And so it was essentially what happens, and I'll kind of give you a little bit of exposition. Back in 1940, there is a medical doctor, his name is D.W. Hoodless, very competent medical doctor that, you know, gets to put a full-blown analysis on these bones, and he gets to examine them, and he's determined that these bones are, in fact, that of a male. And fast forward to 2018, and you have a gentleman by the name of Dr. Richard Jantz, who is one of the foremost authorities on the planet when it comes to forensic anthropology. He actually looks at D.W. Hoodless's original report, looks at photographs of the bones, and looks at his notes, and looks at a lot of other options. And he indicates that, no, that these bones were that, in fact, of a woman. And, in fact, he believes that that woman happened to be Amelia Earhart. And in his report, which is extremely technical, just to get through the abstract, it's very difficult to do. But when you look at his report, the long and short of it is that he concludes with a resounding 99.9% that those bones match that of Amelia Earhart. And, you know, we recently had him on the show. We talked for about 90 minutes and broke that report down from you know, line by line, essentially went through it. And he stands by in that, you know, that report. He believes that, it, you know, until somebody else falsifies his hypothesis, he believes that those bones were, in fact, Amelia's. And, of course, as, you know, things tend to happen in the Amelia Earhart case, they competing camps, of course, you know, took right after that and started trying to poke holes in his hypothesis and you know, explain why they're not Amelia Earhart's bones, in fact. And, you know, it's just been kind of an interesting, you know, back and forth between all the different camps in the last, you know, 6 months or so. It's been really interesting to see kind of how the pendulum swings from one side to another.
Sure, but when he says he's 99% sure, that's not scientifically sure. That's his theory or his belief, right? Because, I mean, he has a picture with a measurement. He doesn't have any DNA. I mean, there's no. I mean, he can't even say 100% for sure it's a female bone, can he?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, he's when he uses, you know, when he compares them to, you know, a control group of, I think the number of the control group is around 2,000. That's kind of where he got his 99% number. And he doesn't have any DNA evidence to support it. It's nothing, you know, nothing concrete to that nature. But he does believe, and it really is, yeah, it is his opinion. But it's an opinion of somebody who is really considered, you know, world renowned in his field. So this isn't just a nobody. This is a guy that, you know, you would call for something like this, for a case of this stature. And it's interesting to note that when we were scripting the interview for him and actually, you know, pulling down notes and kind of coming up with this interview I was going to talk with him about, we had a couple of masters, PhDs that actually were helping me actually script the interview. And what's interesting about that is that when I first started talking to them, they were kind of taken aback because they had told me that this guy is, you know, we learned about him. We studied him in our master's program. This guy was the guy. He's the guy. So to have somebody of that stature say, no, I believe this is with 99% certainty that this is, in fact, the bones of Amelia Earhart. It's, you know, it puts a lot of weight behind that. It's somebody, it's like bringing a star witness in, you know, for a defense or prosecution that just kind of crushes it for that particular team and says, you know, gives them the scientific evidence. With or without DNA, there's other ways to kind of, you know, narrow stuff down. And that's what he's done. He's used a lot of technology to narrow stuff down. And really the question then becomes, do you really believe someone like that, someone with that stature that does not have the bones, the actual physical specimens to look at? Or do you believe the doctor, the medical doctor, who was very competent back in 1940, who actually looked at the bones and indicated that these are that of a man? So it really comes down to what you believe, and who you think had the, I guess, you know, more competency to determine, you know, to determine what bones those were and who they belonged to. So it's, well, sort of an interesting kind of workaround.
Well, the other big thing that was about a year ago was the big documentary. Was it the History Channel or was it National Geographic?
It was History Channel. Yeah, you're referring to the lost evidence probably, right?
So they had that, and with the photograph that supposedly showed Fred Noonan and Amelia possibly having been captured, not on the island of Nicomore, somewhere else, with the possibility of the plane being towed in the background. And so if that really happened, then there wouldn't have been bones on that island, unless something happens where they get sent back there to die, or who knows what happens. But this photo comes out, and it's this big, huge new piece of evidence. And then, like, a week later, a couple days later, a guy's like, no, that photo's in a book here that predates when they're saying this happened. Where are we at with that?
So the folks that worked on the Lost Evidence Project, you know, they came out with that photo. Again, a little exposition. The photo drops about a week in advance. Actually drops during the anniversary of the disappearance, which is really kind of interesting. And so the photo drops, sets the whole world on fire. The documentary comes out, and it's the highest rated documentary show ever. Of that year, rather, by far. And Japanese blogger. After the documentary comes out, which was interesting timing, to wait to that point, since the photo had been out in the media for about a week or so before, decides to do a little Googling and do a little searching on that. And he finds in the Japanese archives that this photo is, in fact, a photo of a Japanese travelogue book. And it was actually taken in 1935, which would make it a physical impossibility for it to be Earhart and Noonan. Now, since that happened, the History Channel sort of put out a Band-Aid, sort of put out a press release and said, we're going to investigate it, independently, and we're going to get back with you. They never got back with anybody. So they did an investigation apparently internally, but we don't know the results of that. We're still not privy to that. However, the gentleman who ran the Lost Evidence Project, Dick Spink and Les Kinney, actually went back to Marshall Islands to do further research on it, and they stand behind that photograph 1,000%, that is, in fact, Erhard and Noonan. Not only that, but that is the Lockheed Electra being towed on the barge behind them. And they actually, Dick is actually coming to Atchison, Kansas in less than a week to present new information and new findings. And unfortunately, we're not privy to those new findings yet. He wants to save that for the discussion panel that we're going to have on, for sure, a larger platform of Erhard enthusiasts that'll be kind of listening and watching along as that discussion panel unfolds. But that's kind of where we're at. They stand behind it. They've done further research. There's actually a second documentary planned. I don't know if it's with the History Channel or not, but I do know that there's a second documentary. I know that they shot about 4 hours of footage for that initial documentary, and only 2 hours made the cut. So they have a lot more. And they say, especially when you see the actual photo, the original photo that was found in the archives, and you look at that in person, that you'll be sold that is, in fact, her and Noonan. So,
well, what is the
stay tuned for more.
What has the blogger said since then, and has anybody found this actual book or any proof of a book having this photo?
There has not been any proof of this book finding the photo, and the blogger has gone dark. There is not any kind of, you know, the blogger hadn't done any interviews or anything. Even when the photo broke and the blogger came out, there was not really a lot on the blogger themselves. We spoke with the blogger through an interpreter and kind of talked to him and, you know, basically told us the same thing he told everybody else. It only took him about 35 minutes to find the photo. It wasn't that long. And then once he found it, he just basically put his findings out there and said, hey, this isn't what you guys think it is. And it hurt. It definitely hurt a lot, I can tell you that. But if you're looking at an entire case, the Japanese capture hypothesis itself is the oldest one out there. It's been around since 1960 when it was pioneered by Fred Gerner a very, very long time ago. And, you know, it's the same thing if you look at a jury trial case or something and there's a piece of evidence that, you know, you can't use or gets thrown out. It throws out that piece of evidence, but it doesn't throw out the whole case. And that's how they're kind of standing behind it. Even if that photo is determined to be 1,000%, you know, inaccurate, that's just one piece in their puzzle and they have so much more to go on. So it's one of those things where, again, they're standing behind it. Blogger's gone dark. They've got some more evidence and we're just all waiting to see what happens.
So I've asked you this before, Chris, and refresh my memory. You believe, so
sure.
So that photo was found in archives or was it recently declassified stuff? How was that photo suddenly found?
Yeah, you know, it was found in the National Archives by a very, very savvy investigator. His name is Les Kinney. He's a retired FBI agent, and he's been doing this for a long time when it comes to investigating the disappearance of Amelia Earhart. And he came across this photo in the National Archives. So it hadn't been recently declassified or anything like that. It was really sort of always there, but it just sort of was kind of looked over a lot. And he just kind of came across this photo. And when he saw the photo, he was just, you know, he was taken aback. And the more information he put into the, you know, digging for the photo, the more, I guess I could say, conclusive in his eyes that photo became. And then he, of course, he contacted the History Channel and contacted Morningstar Entertainment, who was already working on a documentary, and showed him this photo. And then they had the photo looked at by, you know, top forensic photographer analysts, you know, in the country, which we've also talked to, which will be on our, you know, they'll be on our podcast this season, upcoming season. And everybody said, look, this is, you know, they did forensic overlays, as you saw in the Lost Evidence Project and the documentary. And it just, everything checked out over a 98%. Again, there's that 98% number again,
yeah.
98, 99. And, you know, you're having top experts basically tell you, yes, this photo is them. You know, you found it. It's them. And now the Japanese capture, you know, hypothesis has its first piece of massive, you know, tangible evidence in their case. And it's not just eyewitness testimony. Now they have something to go on. So I think that's one of the reasons why they got so excited about it, was because they've been, you know, talking about this for so many decades, and now they have a piece of evidence that they can point to. And of course, we all know what the fallout was with that once that dropped and everything. So,
okay,
it's been kind of a roller coaster.
So, and I've asked you this before, but refresh us. Our government, classified documents, do you think that there is, or do we know that there are many classified documents about Amelia Earhart that if they were opened, maybe would shed a lot of light on what happened?
You know, that's a good question. Yeah, and yes, we have talked about this in the past. We do know that there are documents. Now, what is contained within those documents, we do not know, of course. But we do know there are a lot of documents that are classified that are pertaining to the United, you know, that are pertaining to Amelia Earhart and that world flight. We don't know what, of course, is contained within, but we know they're there. We know that Les Kinney himself has filed for hundreds of Freedom of Information Act requests and been denied for every single one of them. So we do know that. I mean, there's physical, tangible evidence to support that because he's got the requests, he's got the denials, and you know they're saying that they do have stuff. The National Archives does have stuff. I can tell you, as far as a personal thing, when it comes to us, we've reached out to a lot of different folks within the U.S. government, different branches of the government, different government offices. And most of the time I reach out to them, they do say, when we mention the name Amelia Earhart, and, you know, we mention, it's kind of like taboo. If you mention the name Amelia Earhart, a conspiracy in one line, they seem to sort of say, well, we can't touch that. You know, we can't discuss that. We're not at liberty to. It's not, you know, they just kind of shut you down. They just say, no, we can't talk about that. And, you know, we can't, some of them can't, they won't even touch Earhart at all, period. They won't, regardless of, even if you start going out her impact and her legacy and all that stuff, they won't even acknowledge it because they don't want to get into anywhere close into the disappearance or anything surrounding that. So, yes, to answer your question, there are definitely documents. There's definitely information out there. And it's definitely being denied to certain people when they apply for that information. But what's in it, your guess is as good as mine.
All right, so I've got to ask you, have you taken my advice? Yeah, we talked about this last time, and I told you what to do. And I'm telling you, this is the best advice you're going to get, Chris.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? What do you got to do?
I do. And as a matter of fact, we are actually working on that. We've been working on that for a little while since we last got on the show here with you. So, yes, we are working on it. We are taking steps. And we are trying to sort of run and assist, if that makes sense, to certain people.
Well, you've got to find the right people to get that in front of President Trump. But I'm telling you, if you don't have the people on the inside, you got to figure out how to get Fox News interested and get a piece on Amelia Earhart. I think, love or hate the president, that's up to everybody out there. But there's a lot of stuff in the air that is a distraction, and he likes to change the subject and change the story, and for goodness sakes, he's thinking about pardoning the governor of Illinois who's been in jail for 10 years. He will think about this, and especially if you get a fascinating story in front of him that he can read and say, well, what is, you know, he'll be curious, he'll want to know what the hell we know. And I think he's the type of guy who's like, let the people know what's going on. So I really hope you're able to get that in front of President Trump and see if he'll release things, because it'd be fascinating if you're able to get this thing solved because the government knows what happened.
You have a good point. Yeah, it's a very good point. And if anybody is able to do it, it would obviously, if anybody curious to do it, it'd be him. He did release some documentation regarding the Kennedy stuff. So I mean, he's kind of prone to you know, having his interest piqued in doing that. So
we have
already taken action.
So. I don't want to muddy these waters, but especially if there's an FBI cover up angle or something that makes somebody that he's upset with look bad, he's going to like that.
Yeah.
And so I wish you all the best of luck, and I'm very curious to see what happens when this gentleman is presenting new evidence based on, you know, what they found when they were researching more about the photo. How can people find you and find more information, Chris?
So the best way to find us is chasingearhart.com. That's our website. We will be live streaming this event next weekend on social media, on Facebook and Twitter. So if you hit any one of our Facebook, our social media sites, which you can link to from our website, or just facebook.com/chasingearhart, or, twitter.com/chasingearhart, you can watch this discussion panel. It's the largest of its kind, and it's myself and 17 individuals, and we're going to be discussing everything from her impact and legacy to the disappearance and the varying hypotheses, and it's going to be a lot of fun. So hit our website. You'll see everything there, and season 2 of our podcast actually kicks off later tonight with Dave Horner, who is a Japanese capture enthusiast, and he wrote the Earhart Enigma. So we have some really interesting episodes coming up, and we have some really big names coming up this season. So we're excited about season 2, and the documentary will drop next fall. So we're going 100 miles an hour till that's done.
So a trailer this week, will we find that on chasingearhart.com as well?
Yes. So after, it's going to have exclusivity to the event, but once the event is behind us, then the trailer will debut online, and I'll make sure that I shoot that over you guys so you guys can share it if you like. It's going to show, of course, our first footage of our documentary and all of our interview footage, and I think people will be surprised. The trailer is unlike anything you've ever seen when it comes to an Earhart trailer. So it's going to be really kind of an interesting project. And I think it'll excite people again, because we're tackling it in a different manner than everybody else does.
And then the documentary this fall or a year from this fall?
Next fall, fall of 2019. We're still shooting. We still have about we still have about 40 experts we have to shoot for the documentary. We're going to have over 80 experts in our documentary all around the world. So we have a long way to go. We're a little over halfway done shooting, but we still have about a year of shooting still.
Very cool. All right, ChasingEarhart.com, our buddy Chris Williamson. We'll check in with you again soon.
All right, pleasure as always.
All right, thank you so much, Chris Williamson. Again, ChasingEarhart.com. I'm telling you, you get to President Trump, give him a reason to release the documents, get him loose, and you know, maybe they know what happened there. Maybe she was doing a little bit of work for the government there, or maybe she wasn't, but the Japanese thought she was. And that's what happened. That's certainly one of the theories that's out there. All right. It is 3:03 in the morning. Sorry, we ran a little long there. The Steve Cochran Show celebrates the most valuable person on the planet weekday mornings at 7:20 on 720 WGN Chicago. Smart speaker users, just say play WGN Radio on TuneIn. 3:03 in the morning. Let's get your news now, Mr. Badish. Morning, everybody. I could use a dream or a genie or a wish. 312-981-7200 is the number. Matt Bubala Show here on 720 WGN until 5 a.m., which point Max and Orion take over with the morning show. I am fascinated by the whole Amelia Earhart thing.
I know you are.
I think there are like five or six things that really just fascinate me that I could, and I won't, for those of you that don't care, I won't talk about all the time, but Amelia Earhart does fascinate me. And it fascinates me that, you know, there's a possibility that our government knows what happened, or that, you know, it's heartbreaking to me, the possibility that we will just never know. I hate the idea that we'll just never know.
I think the odds are more in that favor than
that
finding out something. Well, finding
right.
out something.
I think by this point, the odds are we're just never going to know. Unless.
Yeah. Well, we've got to see the documentary.
Unless it is known and we just don't know that it's known. I sound like Donald Rumsfeld there for a moment. There are known unknowns and unknown unknowns. but seriously, like, if somebody does know,
right,
it just hasn't been revealed, then maybe someday.
Well,
but I wonder if just nobody knows for sure, at which point I think, like with this guy saying he's looked at the measurements of the pictures of the bones,
mm-hmm.
and now he's 99% sure. Well, come on.
Yeah, but that's measuring bones. You just said if somebody knows and they're not saying, I think anyone who would have known is no longer with us.
Well, it's not that somebody knows and they're not saying, but like there are documents.
Yeah.
There was a government. Now, whether she was actually spying or wasn't spying, but the Japanese thought she was, and so the government knew something and for whatever reason wouldn't reveal it. That's what I would be curious about.
Right. Yeah, I would too. Yeah.
And I hope that someday
I love stories
we
like
find
that.
Out. I do too.
Yeah.
The Malaysia Airlines plane that we talked about again,
MH370.
What the hell happened there?
Still don't know.
We got to get back on one of our MH370 people to talk about that, because the thing that came out about a month ago was that now the theory is that it was a suicide by the pilot. And everybody that we've had on the show, and we've had three or four people, the theory is, no, there was a fire, there was something, hypoxia, everybody knocked out, and they ran, because they run out of fuel. But this thing from a few weeks ago said, no, there were these turns and twists taken towards the end, like they were still evading things and stuff like that. So, I don't know, and how does nothing else show up for all this time?
Yeah.
So I want to know more about that. And the whole D.B. Cooper thing is still killing me.
You get hooked on some of the...
I do get hooked on some of the things. I know.
But it's cool stuff. It's just that...
It's
frustrating.
It's frustrating.
We're hooked on it because it's frustrating.
Yeah.
Right, exactly.
But, I mean, a good mystery is a good mystery.
Oh, sure, sure.
Speaking of...
No.
It just reminded me. So, last summer, I know you don't get HBO, Raj, but Big Little Lies was like the hit of the summer on HBO.
Okay.
It was Nicole Kidman and Reese Witherspoon and Laura Dern and Zoe Kravitz and Peter Skarsgård, I think. Just this really all-star cast.
Mm-hmm.
It was really, really, really good. And HBO Now has a mini-series. I know we don't call them that anymore. A limited event series called Sharp Objects, I think.
I've heard of that, yeah.
And
I haven't seen it, but I've heard of it.
What is the name of the girl who is...
I heard it's getting, like, tremendous reviews.
The first episode was really good. It's shot really... It's slow moving. You really got to take your time with it. But it looks really good. I think that's going to be really...
Now, is it a murder mystery kind of thing, or...?
Well, I'll give you the general. I didn't read the book. Colleen did read the book, so she knows what she's getting into. But from what I've seen so far, who is it? It's not Amy Adams. Or is it Amy Adams?
I think it is Amy Adams.
Amy Adams, okay. She is a reporter, and she gets sent by her boss back to her hometown, where she clearly has family issues because there was a murder there of a young kid, and there was another one a year ago, and maybe there's something to this story.
Mm-hmm.
So she goes back to this little town where she's carrying a lot of baggage and trying to find out, you know, what's going on. And her mother, played by Patricia Clarkson, is going to be a hell of a character, and she's going to be nominated for an Emmy next year.
Oh, wow.
She's pretty fascinating, and it's just, it's going to unfold to a nice little story, I think. And it's really artsy, the cinematography and everything. It's pretty interesting.
Mm.
So I think that's going to be good. Check that out if you can, right, everybody.
I'll try.
And, the interesting thing is, Roger, so we watched the first episode last week, and then you can't watch anymore because it's just coming out every week, and that's really weird to suddenly
We're
so used to watching a show and saying, okay, let's watch the next one.
Mm-hmm.
Have I talked about that we went through this Netflix show, The Staircase?
No, I don't think you did.
It's about this author, I want to say James Patterson, but no, it's not somebody really famous. It's this guy who was an author, Michael Peterson, I think is his name. That's not the name of the killer from here in Chicago, is it? What's the cop's name? Who?
I know who you're talking about, yeah.
Something
Peterson. It's a Peterson, right? But right. Yeah.
So not him, but it's interesting because it's this documentary that was first made like in 2004 or 2001 that followed this guy who had been accused of murdering his wife. She worked for Nortel. They had a mansion. They had adopted all these different kids. And so they're making this documentary about how she fell down the staircase. And the photos in it are just gruesome and crazy.
Mm.
You wouldn't think somebody that fell down a staircase would bleed like this.
Right.
It's all over the walls. It's everywhere. And they had the... So from the moment the police got there, they started looking at it not like a crime scene or not like an accident.
Right.
And he ends up getting arrested. And then there's this big, long trial. As they're researching the trial, they find that earlier in his life, another person whom he had been the last person
had also
died from falling down a staircase. And it's pretty fascinating. So this was first made as like a 6-part, I think, documentary back in the early 2000s. It had a 2-episode follow-up a number of years later, and then a 3-episode follow-up, and now it's owned by Netflix, and it's being pushed all over the place. Somebody texted Scott Peterson. No, that's another one.
Right.
That was the one where Lacey Peterson was pregnant, and he was allegedly out fishing when she died.
Other one disappeared.
And the
previous wife.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, no. Now you're thinking again of the Chicago Cop.
Oh, wait a minute.
Scott Peterson and Lacey Peterson were like a California couple. She goes missing. She's pregnant. He takes part in the search. He does everything to search for her. We find out he had an affair, and he ends up getting arrested.
Oh, I remember that one. Yeah. Yes, I remember that one.
He's in jail now.
Yeah, yeah.
And they made a Lifetime movie. Janelle Maloney,
I remember about that
from The West Wing, played the
did you hear about West Wing?
Affair. No. Is it rebooting?
They got together for like a little get together, and there are rumors that they are going to reboot The West Wing.
That's interesting.
Let me look it up and see if I can get you details. I saw it as like a Twitter tweet. Excuse me.
708 text Drew Peterson.
Drew Peterson is our Peterson.
That's our Peterson.
Yeah.
That's our Peterson. That's our guy that keeps killing all the wives. It's terrible, not even funny.
Yeah.
So anyways, The Staircase on Netflix, well worth your time. It's been our favorite exactly type of thing since Making a Murderer. And everybody says that Making a Murderer and all these, the Jinx on HBO, all these other things that have come out since have been because of this Staircase, because it was kind of groundbreaking at the time. The way it followed didn't really take sides, just kind of laid it out there for you. It is pretty fascinating to watch.
Cool. West Wing cast reunites with Aaron Sorkin. And they are talking reboot. In a photo that will only ramp up speculation, several of the show's core cast members, including Bradley Whitford, Janelle Maloney, and Josh Molina, are seen having dinner with Aaron Sorkin. Molina shared the photo through his Twitter account, along with the caption, "Talking Reboot." For his part, Sorkin has admitted to having an idea for a potential reboot, which would involve casting Sterling K. Brown as president, currently starring in This Is Us. I don't watch that one. There's some kind of jam, an emergency, a very delicate situation involving the threat of war or something, and Bartlett, long since retired, is consulted in the way that Bill Clinton used to consult with Nixon, Sorkin told the Hollywood Reporter.
What? In the way that Bill Clinton, but when Bill Clinton was president, he was consulting with Nixon?
Yeah, apparently.
I never heard that.
Sorkin told the Hollywood Reporter in an interview late last year. The sticking point, according to Sorkin, is how he'd incorporate other favorite characters, such as press secretary turned chief of staff C.J. Craig, or deputy chief of staff turned Matt Santos's right-hand man, Josh Lyman. NBC, which aired The West Wing's original run in the 2000s, is said to be intrigued by the idea, has put the ball in Sorkin's court, speaking to reporters in April. Bob Greenblatt with NBC said a West Wing reboot likely would have already happened if Sorkin weren't busy doing 10 other extraordinary things, his quote.
I would imagine that all those guys are just in high-powered jobs now, and then they somehow get sucked back in.
It could be. Or one went on to become senator, if you remember, from California. Remember, he was the assistant. He went to work for the vice president in the later episodes.
I got
to
watch. See, I gave up on it a couple seasons
what?
Before.
You didn't watch the whole thing?
I don't think I did the last two seasons.
You got to. What do they call that? And when you watch them all back to back
binge.
To back, binge.
Seriously,
you know,
I would like my son to start watching that one.
Oh, that's just tremendous.
440 text, as long as you're looking into those mysteries, see if you can find out what happened to Jimmy Hoffa. He has not turned up yet.
Yes.
And they say, I did check in my shed in the backyard, and he's not there.
Is that what the texter did?
Yeah.
Allegedly. Did he dig deep enough?
Well, did they tear down Giant Stadium? Because there was always the rumor that he got buried in an end zone there, right? They built
the
new stadium.
Was an old rumor. They didn't look there. But the latest was out in a farm somewhere, they tore up the foundation of a barn or a garage or something. That was like within the past 2 years, the latest search for Jimmy Hoffa, and they turned up nothing.
That's going to be another one. Now, that one I'm just not that interested in. You know what else? I've also, I feel bad saying it, but I'm not as curious about JFK anymore.
Really?
I used to be pretty fascinated. I have a lot of books on it. Uh-huh. I've read books on it, and I'm fascinated by the whole. And I've been to Dealey Plaza, and I've been in the book depository. But I don't know. I just feel like that's never going to change. It's just going to be Oswald will be the official, and whether or not something else happened, I don't think we're ever going to know.
No, we're not going to. I don't think that any of the documents that have yet to be released are going to 100% say this, this, and this. I really don't. And I've been through a lot of back when it happened, I went through all of it.
Yeah.
I think it was Kerner, Otto Kerner report. He headed up the commission, the investigation into it, the Kerner report. And I read through that the best I could. It was a humongous document.
Wait, is there a different report? Because the famous one is not the Kerner report.
I thought it was the Kerner report.
No.
It's what's the It's the head of the investigation.
Really,
his name is on
it's
it.
It's not Kerner. It's something with a W. The Warren Commission. It was the Warren Commission.
Kerner Report. Kerner Report in February. Oh, 68. I'm thinking of a different one. Civil Disorders. My bad.
Search Warren Commission. That's the big
one. Yeah. Too many things.
Yeah. We're getting
and
old,
that's a long time. How this is 62. 63.
This is when it happened, at least.
God, I was 11 years old.
So, many, many, many mysteries.
A lot of mysteries,
Raj. We got to get out our mystery machine.
Hey, there's
driving around.
There's our new series. New TV series. We can solve mysteries again.
So we'll combine the Scooby-Doo kids with Father Dowling.
Yes.
We'll take the Father Dowling mysteries and Scooby-Doo, and we'll sort of combine that together in some way, and we'll hit the road.
Yeah. Well, I forgot to tell you, here's another great one. Endeavor on PBS.
What is that?
That is the Inspector Morse was a series on PBS. Great series. And Endeavor is the early years of Inspector Morse on the police force, where he's like a deputy inspector. And there's his boss in this, the chief of detectives. And there was an episode, the end of one season, like the first or second season, because it's in the fifth season now. And Bridget and I love this show. And something happens to his boss. And Bridget just gets, oh, my God, she's distraught. And I says, well, do you want to see the next episode for the next season, season three? And she goes, no, I want to, but I don't want to. I don't want to watch it now. I don't have time. But I want to know. Oh, my God, I can't believe if he's. And the deal was, I'm sitting there, like, biting my tongue. Because in my channel searching at home during the day, they're broadcasting season 5 on channel 11. And I already knew the answer to what happened.
So you acted really smart and pretended to
I said something like, are you sure you don't want to see it? I said, don't get too upset. She says, what do you know? Did you already watch it? I go, no. I'll just leave it like that. It was, I kept her, and I told her after we saw the next episode, I finally told her, I says, I knew he wasn't, you know, nothing was going to happen to him. Because I saw that he was in, and I'm trying not to, as I flip through season 5, you know, as I go to channel 11, and it's on, I go, no, I can't watch it. And I keep going past it. So I'm trying not to watch ahead when I haven't even seen the first episodes. But it's an excellent, oh my gosh, it's like a Sherlock Holmes type of mystery. A great whodunit.
It's called Endeavor. And what's
it's Endeavor. It's on PBS. And it takes place in, it's in England, and it's in, I can't remember. And we were there. We were there for our trip when we went to England. I gotta look. I am getting old, and I'm older than you.
While Roger is looking up his history, 847, the Warren Commission was about Kennedy, right? Yes, it was. 870, they tested the end zone at Giant Stadium with ground penetrating radar and found no anomalies, no Hoffa. 618 says, let's not forget about the Zodiac. I thought they figured out the Zodiac. What's the one?
The Zodiac Killer?
Where they just realized it was a cop. This is something in San Francisco. That was different.
That was not the Zodiac, but that was another famous series of murders.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the Zodiac's still never been figured out.
I don't think so. Okay. Why? Oh, the episodes are. Ooh, they're online.
All right. While Roger gets carried away, let's take a break before he's got to do the news. Chicago is hosting the ultimate month-long food festival this August. Visit ctfoodbowl.com to get your seat at the table. News next, 720 WGN.
There's an amazing supper club in Wisconsin Dells, Ish Nala. Nestled among the pines and perched above the sandstone bluffs of Mirror Lake. The beauty, the history, the service, the food, the fun. Hi. This is Bob Prosser, owner of Ishnala Supper Club in Wisconsin.
That was released. And let's read from this a little bit. This one is going to be, let's start with the New York Times.
Okay.
The nation's top intelligence officer said on Friday that the persistent danger of Russian cyber attacks today was akin to the warnings the U.S. had of stepped-up terror threats ahead of the September 11th, 2001 attacks. That note of alarm, sounded by Dan Coats, the director of national intelligence, came on the same day that 12 Russian agents were indicted on charges of hacking the Democratic National Committee and Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign. Mr. Coates said those indictments illustrated Moscow's continuing strategy to undermine the U.S. democracy and erode its institutions. So from Political, here's what they say. The Russia's special counsel described in rich new detail how Russian military intelligence officials infiltrated Democratic servers with fearsome skill. Now, believe in all this or not, whatever you want. You can still think this is a witch hunt, but still believe that all this happened. Now, whether you think that they're trying to get at Trump, whatever, what we do know and what is accepted by Republican leaders is that Russia attacked our system, that Russia tried to gain an upper hand or tried to control some things. Now, you don't have to believe that any Trump associate knew anything of it or was part of it or any of that. And I'm not saying that they did. We don't know any of that. What we know is Russia really had something going here, because you got to listen to this. And Republican leadership is not denying this. So it's not whether there's a witch hunt or not. You can believe that. But this don't take away this as part of this. This is not fake news. This is what really happened, according to our top intelligence. And not just, oh, somebody, not some Democrat. OK, this is real. And it is pretty
scary.
Insidious. I mean, it's Russia wasn't just, you know, it wasn't the 400-pound guy in his bedroom stumbling upon something.
Mm-hmm.
Friday's indictment shows that frontline Russian intelligence agents who U.S. officials believe hacked the 2016 election, some of the world's most capable cyber warriors, shows how they operate and how they did a lot more than steal and disseminate embarrassing emails from Democratic Party officials. The operatives from two units within Russia's GRU military intelligence agency meddled in the election through an elaborate series of coordinated high-tech influence operations and by using a global network of anonymous servers, Bitcoin purchasers, and other unwitting cutouts to cover the digital tracks, according to the indictment. And according to the 14-page charging document, the Russians deeply infiltrated two key Democratic Party organizations and key aspects of Democrat Hillary Clinton's campaign, watching their every move via real-time digital surveillance until just weeks before the election. That kind of extraordinary capability allowed the Russians to, quote, virtually look over the shoulders of Democratic campaign staffers in real time throughout most of the 2016 campaign. I mean, think about that for a second. All these staffers, basically, they're seeing everything they're doing every moment. They're recording keystrokes. They're seeing everything they're doing on their computers throughout in real time. Ed McAndrew, a former federal cybercrime prosecutor and Justice Department lawyer, said that he attributed the, quote, extremely high level of sophistication of the Russian GRU hackers to their ability to combine sophisticated social engineering techniques and custom design malware with more simple spear phishing techniques used to obtain passwords of more than 300 unsuspecting victims from the Democratic Party. 300! That's pretty good. These GRU units are dedicated, well-organized, and well-funded, and they're perfectly capable of causing havoc in our electric grid as well as insecure election systems. So that's a scary thought, that they could possibly hack into our election or electric grid and cause problems there. That was said by Joel Brenner, top official at the National Security Agency and Directorate of National Intelligence during the Bush and Obama administrations. Nasty was how Brenner described the GRU activities laid out in the 14-page indictment, which disclosed the names of 12 Russian military officers who allegedly led the campaign. The indictment also disclosed for the first time the names of the units within the GRU, officially known as the Main Intelligence Directorate of the Russian General Staff, that prosecutes said led effort, said led the effort, that prosecutors said led the effort. Sorry. One of them, Unit 26165, meticulously hacked and stole the information, while the other, 74455, set up the elaborate infrastructure around the world that was used to disseminate the material and make it look like a series of unrelated incidents. At a news conference Friday, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein summarized the case against the 12 Russians as a crime of money laundering, aggravated identity theft, and conspiracy to access computers without authorization, all done in furtherance of their efforts to influence the election. The indictment went into far more detail, describing how Unit 26165 hacked and stole vast troves of data from the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee beginning in March 2016, and then used that access to do the same thing to the DNC. By April 2016, the GRU operatives hacked and stole more than 50,000 emails from Clinton campaign chairman John Podesta and other campaign officials. Then they released them at strategically opportune times, the indictment said, though through various cutouts and websites they set up and operated with fictitious personas, including as Americans. By capturing the keystrokes and computer activities of their victims, they also captured communications about fundraising, voter outreach projects, data about the DCC's finances, personal banking information, and even files about Clinton's Achilles heel, the Benghazi investigations. They also accessed third-party cloud computing services to obtain politically valuable data about the DNC's analytics, according to the indictment. Both units covered their tracks so meticulously through an elaborate series of counter-surveillance measures that they secretly remained inside the Democrat systems until October 2016, the indictment said, despite the efforts of a top U.S. cybersecurity firm to flush them out that began 5 months earlier. So 5 months, they couldn't get them out of there. It's like having roaches in your house.
Yeah.
CrowdStrike, the cybersecurity company hired by the DNC, declined to comment. Because it took them
because
a long
they're
time.
Not that good.
Like, they kind of beat us on that one. We don't have a comment. DNC Chair Tom Perez didn't address the issue specifically, except to say in a statement that the GRU unit's efforts to disrupt the electoral process, quote, have grave implications for our democracy. Today's indictment makes clear just how vast this operation was, Perez said. That scope included the GRU unit's penetration of a state election board's website, from which they stole information related to about 500,000 voters. The former Justice Department and NSA cybersecurity officials said the indictment also was noteworthy for what it said about the multi-agency U.S. effort to unravel the GRU unit's activities back in 2016 and to gather enough evidence about the individuals responsible to prosecute them in federal court. Brenner, the former NSA senior official, said the investigation must have been, quote, amazingly thorough. For instance, to be able to identify the GRU agents operating behind the scenes, including those who engineered the custom malware used in the DNC intrusions. I don't know how you do this except by penetrating the defendant's systems, Brenner said. Our intel services should be congratulated. So that's crazy. And the big headline that came out of it, I think that's really crazy. But the big story that came out of it today was on the date. You remember that President Trump made a comment. They said it was at 10:27 in the morning. Hey, Russia, if you're listening, I hope you can find Hillary's 30,000 missing emails. That things kicked into high gear later that day.
Yeah.
Now, whether...
Read whatever you want into that.
Yeah. That doesn't mean that he knew they were doing that
right.
Or could do that. He wasn't sending them a coded signal. I don't believe them at all. But they certainly hacked in. And what will be interesting to find out, because I think they're looking into everything with the DNC, but I doubt that they weren't trying to do the same things to the Republicans. And I wonder if they had success in doing that. Because while maybe they wanted Trump to win, thinking that would be better, I'm sure they want dirt on all of them as well. And, you know, one of the earlier reports said it wasn't, and I don't know where they're at with this, but that it wasn't necessarily at one point to help Trump win the election. It was to create havoc and cause problems in America, right? And maybe later they turned to wanting him to beat Hillary. But I think when it was a big primary process and stuff, it was more about just causing problems.
There's another part that kind of disturbs me in that report, and you didn't read it. In some of the documents, there is reference to an unnamed congressperson or a sitting member of Congress that had contact with this information, this stolen information. And I'd like to find out who that is or was. And I'm sure that is still being investigated by Mueller and his team, and that there will be more indictments to come down. We're not done with this. This is not over, and the depth of this and the effectiveness of this, I think they're just touching the surface, to be honest with you.
Matt Lyle with you, 720 WGN. Morning show with Max and Orion coming up at the 5 o'clock hour. Roger Badish in the newsroom. Jess Rains answering the phones. When you call 312-981-7200, you can also text that number as well. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studios in our new home on Wacker Drive, where
apparently the pizza delivery driver can't find it. You know when I have this kind of pizza? The day after.
Roger, everybody has a bad night. First night on the job. Now, texter from 630 says, Roger, you are right on target.
Thank you.
870 says, so what was wrong earlier is Roger was hangry. 2 hours is BS. They should have made you a fresh pie and the manager should deliver it for free.
And that was what I asked Jess before when she said, well, they sent someone else from the store to go find the guy. And I said, well, I hope he's got a fresh pizza that's warm. She said, no.
Maybe there'll be a credit issue.
I hope so. We like them.
We do. It's good pizza.
Delicious pizza.
It's good pizza.
Yes.
Sometimes
at
people have
4 o'clock in the morning.
4 o'clock in the morning. Well, it would have been 1 o'clock.
Yeah, but still.
But it's still good.
Yeah.
That's why we have microwaves, people.
I know, but it doesn't
I understand. Yes, it does.
No, it Oh,
man, you really are. Wrong side of the bed tonight.
I'm a pizza aficionado.
Oh, boy. Here we go.
I used to make my own fresh, all imported ingredients.
Really?
Yeah.
Was it good?
Oh. Instead of pepperoni, I used prosciutto.
Mmm.
Ooh.
That sounds delicious.
Yeah, it was very good.
Speaking of exotic locations and ingredients, our friend Mark Shipper, formerly of DNAinfo.com, is in Spain. He's at the San Fermin Festival in Pamplona that I think is wrapping up today. But let's check in with him right now and find out for sure. Hey, Mark, how are you this morning, bud?
I'm good, Matt. How are you doing today?
We are doing good. So is today, Saturday, the last day of the festival, or did it wrap up yesterday?
Today is the last day. We had the last entierro this morning, and it'll end tonight at midnight with a ceremony they call Pobre de mi, Poor Me.
And what happens at that ceremony?
That is a farewell. We sing a song called Pobre de mi, which translates to Poor Me. Everybody gathers in the same place they gather for Chupinazo, and in the big square in the middle of town, we sing this song, and we say farewell. And immediately afterwards, we start saying, ya falta menos, it is less, meaning it's one day closer than next year already. It's kind of an emotional wind down, actually. There's a lot of tears shed, and a lot of people say goodbye. They only see each other this one time a year, so it's kind of a nice way to close it.
I've seen some of the videos and photos you put on Twitter and Facebook. How big, paint the picture a little bit of the size, because it sounds like an intimate gathering in some ways, about when people are all going to gather in the town square for this, say, closing ceremony. How many people do you estimate will be there?
Oh, it's intimate, all right, in the sense that you have absolutely no personal space. It'll be tens of thousands. Okay, they'll pack the streets and they'll pack the square. It's there are a lot of people, and especially because it's ending on a Saturday, a lot of people come down from France over the weekends, and the closer to Bastille Day you are, which is the 14th, the bigger the crowd you get. So today it could be a huge crowd. We'll find out later.
About how big of a city is San Fermin? How many people live there normally?
It's around 150,000, okay. And the population, they say, during the ferry swells by like anywhere by to a million to a million and a half. So,
oh my God,
a lot of people show up.
So is it impossible to get a hotel right there? Most people have to hotel half an hour away and then come in every day?
I wouldn't say it's impossible, but you have to be smart about it. You have to book your hotel. Some people start booking their hotel just days after San Fermin ends. It helps to know people to get a place. I don't know about a lot, but a certain number of locals leave for the ferry. They just take off for the week. And they rent out their apartments kind of, what's the rental service I'm thinking of?
Like an Airbnb type thing?
Well, Yeah, an Airbnb type situation. They rent out their apartments for the week and make quite a bit of money. But the hotel prices, particularly if you're in the middle of town, jump like 4 or 5 times, if not more. The hotels are extremely expensive.
Where did you stay? Do you have a friend that you made that you stayed with, or how did you pull it off?
Yeah, actually, I have a couple of people out here that I know, so I'm kind of lucky. I got an inside track. I have an Airbnb style. I rented out an apartment from someone who lives here permanently who just left for the week and went on holiday. So I have a great place right in the middle of town, and actually, I paid a good price for it, so I'm fortunate.
Interesting. So now, do you head out of town today, or are you staying a couple more days?
I will be here tonight, and then I get on a train tomorrow, actually, from Pamplona to Madrid. And I couldn't get out of Madrid tomorrow night, so I'll leave Monday morning. I'll spend one night in Madrid, and then the following morning I'll hop on a plane straight back to Chicago, direct flight.
Now, Mark, is this the type of thing you said that a lot of people are saying goodbye? They're sad because it's the one time a year they see each other. Have you made friends that you would come back to see, hopefully year after year, that you'll get together with and have gotten to know just through this festival?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I made some last year when I was working on the documentary, and then made a few more this year. And, yeah, we, you know, exchange emails and friend up on Facebook or whatever social media you have. And, yeah, I got a few more this year, so 100%. It'll be great to keep in touch with a little bit over the course of the year, but it'll be even better to see him next year. So, yeah, the plan is most likely to come back again.
Is it the type of thing that once you've gone to it a couple times, it's not, oh, okay, I got that out of my system, that you would like to come back year after year after year?
Yeah, you kind of get bit by the bug. It gets in your blood, and as the year starts passing by, it starts kind of boiling up and showing itself, and you start thinking about it, and you want to come back. So I can see, depending on how you take the ferry, I could see it being a bucket list kind of thing that you do once, and you just go crazy for 8 days, and then you've done it, and you don't need to do it again.
Mm-hmm.
But I think for other people, it's something that's like a special yearly gathering. You look forward to it. It's 9 days out of every year, and it's something you want to do every year. There are a lot of people here who've been here 30 plus times, and others who are well on the right way 10 plus times, 12 plus times, and they have no plans to stop coming.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. Now, last week when we talked,
yeah,
you had not run with the Bulls, and you were debating it when we talked about it last week. So now it's over. All the Bull runs have been done. Did you run with the Bulls?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I did.
You did?
And I did do it, and I picked for my running day, lucky Friday the 13th.
Well, you're talking to us now, so you survived. Tell us about it. What was it like?
I did survive it. Yeah, it's as gnarly and scary as it looks. No matter where you see it from TV in person, it's an intense experience. The thing I think that surprised me most about it is how difficult it is to see the bulls and the herd. Part of that's because of the people, and part of it's because how fast it happens. You know, I talked to a lot of people. I had a lot of information going into it. I had a game plan, which I think is the smartest way to do it, which is know exactly where you want to run and know exactly how you want to get off the course. And I had it timed out pretty well and everything. And by the time when the bulls got to me and I saw the spot I wanted to start running from, I followed my game plan. And there was a lead bull that had separated from the pack, which they call a swelto, which are the most dangerous kind of bulls when they're on their own. And he blew by me on the right. And I saw him and he was past me before I even really had a chance to figure out what was going on. So I kept running. He went past. He clobbered a guy up in front of me to the right. I actually didn't get a medical report on that guy, but I think he was gored. That lead bull smashed into another guy at the curve up ahead of me and just mashed him against the wall. But that guy was okay. He was wearing a Saquon Barkley Penn State jersey. Saquon Barkley was just taking the NFL draft. I was hanging around near that kid when the run started. And, you know, so it's interesting. If he would have been hurt worse, it would have been crazy. You could, you know, you don't even know whoever you're standing by.
Yeah.
Maybe they'll be there after the run's over and maybe they won't. It's like you just kind of find out afterwards. I had a few people texting me, making sure I was all right. And so after that lead bull went by, I kept running. I kept looking back over my shoulder, and the pack came through next, kind of wide right up above my right shoulder, and they blew by, and they were just gone in a few seconds. And when it was over, I was thinking, like, if something went wrong and the pack turned your way and a bull put you in its crosshairs, you'd have to be a major league expert to get out of there safely, because it just the speed of the thing at ground level is amazing.
So it's interesting. Like, I always thought if I ever did this, I'd start out, I'd run a certain amount. Once a bull got near me, I'd, know a place to jump the fence and get off. Because you see a lot of times in the video highlights of people, once the bulls are coming, they're jumping over fences, getting out of the way. But you kept running or let them pass you. That's really taking a risk, isn't it? Because if, like you said, if one turns towards you, they're going to get you.
Yeah, most likely they will. Yeah, I had my exit route, so I knew where I wanted to get off the course, and I wanted to try and run with them as best I could. I didn't want to get off the course before the bulls had showed up, or be gone before it happened. I figured I was going to do it. I wanted to try and do it correctly. But yeah, when it was over, I really thought about it, and it just happened faster than I thought, because I was so well prepared mentally. Mm-hmm. And I'd watched it so many times. I'd watched every section of the course, and I talked to so many runners, and I had so much knowledge. I kind of thought I had it under control a little bit, but man, it's the difference between watching and doing. It's like watching a football game on TV and then getting in there and being stunned at how fast it is at field level.
I imagine it is. When so from the time they release them, from the pen that they're released from to the ring that they enter, how far of a run is it? If you started right where they're released and ran all the way, how far would that be?
Yeah, it's a little more than a half mile, with a lot of uphill sections, at least slightly uphill. The first section, not steeply, but a definite uphill grade and multiple turns. It's a little bit more than a half mile.
So if you ran it from front to end, 7 minutes really at the most, probably, unless you're getting delayed in some way, shape, or form, right?
Yeah, if you were a person running it, yeah, maybe. I don't know. The bulls do it in just under 3 minutes, or right about 3 minutes.
Wow, that's, they're hauling that.
Oh, my. They are incredibly fast. It's crazy how fast they are.
And how many bulls get released?
Especially uphill. Six bulls and six steers. So that's the other thing. The steers, luckily, really keep a straight line course. The steers don't want to run into anybody, and they're non-aggressive. So that's good and bad. They keep the bulls moving, but when you're trying to run, you can really get blockaded by a lot of steers. These steers are very big, but they're very docile.
And the steers run in front?
They run with. Depending, if you watch it on TV, when you see it, the steers are the big brown cows with the long horns. Depending on how the run goes, ideally they stay together in a pack. Nobody gets gored, and these animals just make a straight line run to Plaza de Toros. But most mornings they get separated in some way, and even these little just separated spaces are what the good runners are looking for. They want to duck in between the steers and get onto the bull's horns. So the runners who are good enough to do that, obviously the game has slowed down for them, and they can spot their openings. But the spot I ran in, there was that one swelter, like I said, who ran up front, but the rest of the herd was really tightly together. So when they blew by me, I saw mostly steer on the outside, and I saw some bull and horn kind of on the inside. But when they passed me, they were really in a pretty tight herd.
So the really good runners try to sort of mix in with the steer, and then let the bull's horns get as close to them as possible?
Yeah, well, it's not really letting the bull's horns get close to you. They call it running en los cuernos, running on the horns, meaning just running up in front of the bull. And the idea is the kind of the mystical perfection of a run is having the bulls accept you as part of the herd. Not necessarily a steer, not necessarily a bull, just part of the herd. And you run with them. And that's what the great runners are trying to do. They're shooting for the mythically perfect run, which is right on the horns, right in the arena. And some guys here are pretty much doing it. They're good enough to do that.
That's fascinating. I got a quick call coming in from Scott in Wisconsin. Scott, you're on with Mark in Pamplona, Spain on WGN. How are you?
Very good. I was wondering if Mark ever tracked down, last time you talked to him, you said the meat from the steers or the bulls was sold. I didn't know if he had an opportunity to consume any of it or found out where it went.
Good question. Hold on. So, Mark, Scott was asking last week, we talked about the bulls that are slaughtered and the meat, and you thought it got shipped off to restaurants, things like that. Have you heard any more about that?
I don't know which places buy it, but I did find out that all the meat is pre-sold before the bulls ever enter the arena. So there's a contractual agreement in place. It varies completely depending on the region of Spain you're in and who has a need for meat. I did not find out if any particular restaurant in Pamplona sells the bulls killed in Pamplona.
When so we know it's part of it is a big drinking party. Does the party during the week, during this whole festival, is it going all night long? Like, could you head out of your room at 3 in the morning and find people still in bars, or does it calm down at night and pick up again during the next day?
There's madness at every hour if you're looking for it. Last night in particular, because it was the last full night, It went on all night. I came in a little bit earlier. I took a little day trip up to San Sebastian to the coast to get a little swim in the water and relax. And so I was kind of in my room, and I was just listening out the window. The party went all night. Now after NCO, it's finally calmed down. I think people are going to go to sleep for a while and then come back out tonight. But no, you can get action any hour of the night if you want it.
All right, this is going to be a very 2018 question, but is Tinder something that people are using like crazy during something like this?
Well, I have a girlfriend at home, Matt, so I don't even explore these kind of things.
I'm not saying you would be using it. I just mean you're observing what's going on with the culture. You're a journalist, so you're seeing what's going on, and what I'm just trying to get an idea of. Are there, you know, is this like, if it's a big drinking party, partially, so I imagine it's also a big hookup type of thing.
You know, I'm going to have to say right now that the Tinder angle is not a huge one here. Amongst the foreigners, people seem to travel in groups to this thing.
Okay.
So I think most of what goes on there is people traveling in groups with friends and then meeting other groups. It's much more of a face-to-face thing. There's also there's a little bit of a cultural difference between like Spain and the United States, Spain and England, Spain and Australia. And up here culturally, I don't know that the meet online and quick hookup culture is as big here as it is elsewhere. So I would say most meetup stuff is done here face-to-face, and it's done amongst groups who travel. You know, a lot of people travel in groups of, you know, 2, 4, 6,
sure,
8, and everybody just gets together at different spots. So I think it's much more of a face-to-face barrier, to be honest. And then the Spanish, the Basques, the Navarrans, they're all together. They kind of stick with each other.
But it's very welcoming, right, especially for tourists at this time. I know that the festival depends on tourists, but is it very welcoming to Americans right now in Spain?
Extremely welcoming. I think for me, in my travels, Spain is the most hospitable culture to outside people in terms of wanting to share their culture, share their food, share their music, and all their events. They're extremely welcoming, friendly people.
Excellent. Well, any last thing to report before you head back home, Mark?
Well, no, I don't think I have anything to report, but it's a long week at the end of this. I'm telling you, I'm getting ready to get through Pobre de Mi, come back, get another good night's sleep, and get on that train back. By the end of this week, you've been out in a lot of sun, and a lot of energy has been expended. So it's a great time, but by the time it's over, they have to cut this thing off at a certain point, or nobody would ever make it back home.
I would imagine, like, you know, as you're getting older, you're like, this is like 10 crazy college nights all packed into one. There's got to be times where you're like, I can't do this anymore.
Oh yeah, there are times when you just have to get off the street. I gotta go to my room. I gotta get some darkness in the bed for a little while, or I'm gonna go mad.
You can follow Mark on Twitter at MyTimesPros, at MyTimesPros, P-R-O-S-E. See a lot of great photos from his travels Mark, we'll talk to you again when you get back to the States.
All right, Matt. Thanks for having me on. Take care.
Thank you so much. Safe travels. Mark Schipper, who is out at San Sebastian. He was in Pamplona. He's there right now for the San Fermín Festival, wrapping up today. He ran with the Bulls. That is on the bucket list. Matt Bubala with you, 720 WGN.
Marian Hossa, consistently good. Love that he came to our city.
Marian Hossa,
number 81.
Marian Hossa.
I speak for our fans, our players, and coaches tonight when I say Marian Hossa, we are proud. You are a Chicago Blackhawk.
Thanks, Hoss. From the station that was always at its best when you were.
Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Every man's fantasy may be a hot wife, but trust me, no man wants a wife that's hot.
Elizabeth, am I in trouble again?
No, Dick, I'm talking about getting overheated. That's my husband, Dick Hochschild, owner of American Weathermakers. So, when your air conditioner breaks down...
And Elizabeth, it always happens on the hottest day of the year.
That's when you want expert, honest service fast.
Call American Weathermakers 60 Minute Men. We'll come to your rescue, day or night, in 60 minutes or give you a free $60 gift card for repairs. And we never charge for travel or overtime. Plus, we offer a lifetime warranty on our repairs. Call us for details.
And I love that you offer the best prices on repairs and air conditioning equipment every day. You'll fall in love with American Weathermakers, too.
American Weathermakers, we won't be comfortable until you are.
Call toll-free.
855-955-HVAC.
For special offers, visit our cool website, AmericanWeathermakers.com.
At Muller Volkswagen, we realize that buying a car is never easy, which is why we always do our best to exceed your expectations. And there's no doubt we will during our Summer of Savings event. Take a test drive in the all-new 2019 Jetta and get great savings on every vehicle. We're confident we have something for everybody. Muller Volkswagen. Visit us today in Highland Park, conveniently located right off I-94, or at MullerVolkswagen.com. You will not be disappointed.
Hey Chicago, Jim Schultz here. Do you manage a rental property or run a business that relies on commercial laundry machines? Chances are your machines are old, inefficient, or unreliable, and most likely all three. For over 10 years, Midwest Laundries has been supplying high-quality, American-made Primus commercial washers and dryers throughout Chicagoland. Hotels, athletic facilities, salons, healthcare, we handle it all. Stop by our huge equipment showroom and parts department at I-55 in California, or check out our five-star reviews online at MidwestLaundries.com. That's MidwestLaundriesIES.com, and see how the right machines make all the difference.
Hi everyone, it's Dave Hoekstra here, inviting you to join me on a WGN tour of Ireland this fall. We'll see Dublin, Derry, Donegal, and more, all highlighted by a very special Van Morrison concert in Belfast. Imagine seeing Van Morrison perform in a 350-seat hotel ballroom in his hometown. It's the sights and sounds of Ireland, and I'm sure some wild nights. We leave September 30th. More information at SteveBertrandTravel.com or call Steve at 847-606-6065. But hurry, the seats are limited.
All right, so here we go, Raj. Here's two more Bertrand travel trips if he would ever take our call.
Yep.
Next year, we go with a bunch of people to run with the Bulls.
Ooh. Ooh. Yes. Let's do it.
Now, maybe that's not the preeminent WGN listener trip.
Why not? Spain?
Spain, yes. Running with Bulls, probably not as much. You're going to get out and run with them, Raj?
You bet your sweet Bippy I am.
You really would?
I would. Not I would stumble and fall and be trampled, but I would run with them.
That I'd like to see.
And you're running right next to me.
Yes, I would. It's on my bucket list. I want to do it.
Let's do it.
I have a buddy that who's a CEO of a company we work with, and they travel all the time, and he did it
A
couple years ago. Yeah.
What did he say?
I can't remember if I talked to him extensively about it. I remember he put a picture out on Facebook, but I don't remember. Like, Mark really ran with the Bulls. Like, I always thought I'd run, then you see a bull, and you jump the hell over the wall.
Right.
But he's done it enough, and he's felt the culture enough that I think he didn't want to be the dude that did that. He wanted to try to, really stick with it and run.
Well, you said, I remember you saying last week, when you said your friend was going to be on this week, that it's not a real long run.
I didn't realize it was that short. I didn't realize
it was 3 minutes. Yeah, I didn't either. I thought it was like all the way through town, you know?
Well, I don't think it's that big of a town.
Well,
but I mean, half mile in a smaller downtown area is
half mile, especially twists and turns.
Yeah.
Being chased.
And I think it's like, I want to say, if I recall the video correctly, it's a lot of like brick paved streets.
Yeah.
Because I know it's slippery for the bulls a lot of times. They're falling all over the place.
Well, I mean, I don't think hooves were meant to be
for running. Like
brick,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah. So we got that one.
We got to do it. And now, I got to tell you. I know I got to do news, but I got to tell you. Somebody, I can't remember who, someone here at the station, on during another time of the day, without me saying anything to them, said, yeah, we're working on getting a remote broadcast up at Ishnala.
For our show?
No, for their show.
Well, that's not good.
No. I didn't want to throw out our, you know, hey, you're going to have to stand in line behind us because we're already. No, because nobody's saying anything to us from sales that we got the gig.
Well, A, they don't know we're asking because they're not listening. B.
Have you sent an email?
I'm guessing that, you know, if Ro's show wants to go.
I don't know. I can't remember if it's his show or someone else's.
Any of the shows that are on during the day are going to get precedence,
I'm guessing.
A, because they're on during the day. B, because it's when Ishnal is actually open.
Yes. But still, we could do a nice overnight thing.
We could.
And, you know, some shows have pre-taped those kinds of things.
We're not doing that.
And aired it back. Like the next weekend or something.
We don't do that on this show.
No, we go live.
We are live all the time.
Live and local, baby. We got to work something out.
Yes, but that wasn't my other trip. My other trip.
Oh.
We get a bunch of people and Chris Williamson, and we go to Nakamura to that crazy island, and we search for Amelia Earhart.
Oh my gosh!
How much fun would that be?
Bucket and shovels for everyone.
Yeah, and all those little sand crabs you can avoid.
Right.
I mean, it would be kind of be a roughing it one. But
so put up a couple of tents.
A little more adventure.
Yes.
Oh, go to Ireland, hear Van Morrison Hotel. Whatever.
Yeah.
Let's go find Amelia Earhart. That's a trip, baby. Let's go run with the bulls. Yeah. Spend your money on that.
There you go. Yeah, we got to. Let's
get up off our butts and do something.
I want to. You know what? I want to see Jess run with the bulls.
Jess, would you run with the bulls?
No.
Why?
It took me 26 years to get on an airplane. Do you think I'm, I don't know, maybe.
Maybe.
We're not talking about flying.
You'd have to fly,
done flying over there, you'll run with the bulls.
Which is a good 8-hour flight, so you'll be hammered by the time we get there.
On the airplane?
What do you do to overcome your fear? You don't drink on the plane?
No.
Oh, well, maybe that was where you screwed up.
Although I do think that we should take a trip adventure somewhere. That would be cool.
A trip adventure somewhere. Sounds like a good plan. And the mystery machine will pull up and we'll all jump in.
I'm still working out the details. I'll have an update by next weekend.
Oh, you'll have plans next weekend? Okay.
No, for a show.
You know that we're 5 minutes late for news now, everybody.
We are?
Make Sundays your official night to tour the city, watch Chicago's Best at 10, and stick around for the latest in shopping, entertainment, and events on See Chicago at 10:30 p.m. on WGN-TV. News headlines right now, Mr. Battish.
Southern Illinois University says Randy Dunn is stepping down as the school's president. He's been criticized over his handling of a proposal to shift $5.1 million in state funding from the school's Carbondale campus to the Edwardsville campus. Dunn will still get a six-month severance package of $215,000. Despite a growing mood of detente on the Korean Peninsula, ongoing sanctions are keeping life-saving medicines and supplies from tens of thousands of North Korean tuberculosis patients. U.S.-backed sanctions and the fear of angering Washington by even unintentionally violating them have squeezed humanitarian aid to North Korea, aggravating one of the world's most stubborn tuberculosis hotspots. 37-year-old woman overdosed but was saved by officers moments after she walked into a suburban Chicago jail to turn herself in on an arrest warrant. Lake County Sheriff Mark Curran says a short time after the woman arrived at the jail, she collapsed on the floor and became unconscious. We'll check sports, traffic, and weather next on WGN.
Tom, I'm having vanity issues.
Lindsay, the producer of the House Smart Show, has vanity issues?
Well, I want to remodel my bathroom and need a new vanity cabinet. That's why I'm here at the Edge Kitchen and Bath Showroom in your Builder's Supply Outlet.
No one has more vanities in stock. No one. Forget cheap particle board. We're talking all wood construction with full extension cushion closed drawers.
Wow, look at this beautiful vanity.
That's our 48-inch comfort height shaker vanity. Only $449.
And these tops come in so many colors.
We stock over 400 gorgeous granite and quartz vanity tops, all at true outlet prices.
Before you make a vanity purchase, make the drive to the Edge Kitchen and Bath Showroom in Builder Supply Outlet on Cermak Road in Broadview, or the newest location of The Edge on 151st Street in Orland Park.
High-end look without the high-end price.
The Edge
Kitchen and Bath Showroom
from Builder Supply Outlet.
Or visit edgekitchenandbath.com.
WGN Sports, White Sox and Kansas City this afternoon. Annie Mazur starts it all off with your pregame at 12:35. Play-by-play at 1:10 with Ed Farmer and Darren Jackson right here at 720 WGN. White Sox beating KC yesterday 9-6. Cubs over San Diego yesterday 5-4, took them 10 innings. They'll play again tonight. WNBA Washington over the Chicago Sky. WGN traffic, no trouble spots out there except on northbound I-57 near 127th Street. The road is closed right now with an accident. We're not seeing any delays in that spot right now, as traffic is very, very light, and we expect that to be cleared up fairly soon. For personalized traffic on demand, get the Traffic Chicago app approved by the mortgage experts of Team Hochberg. Just search TRAFFIX Chicago. Forecast from the WGN Chicago Weather Center. We've got rain throughout the region on and off through today, tonight, and on Sunday. Today's high around 86. Sunday, humidity comes back in, and we get a high near 89, but near 100 heat indexes further inland. Temperatures around the area right now, 77 at O'Hare, 78 midway and along the lakefront, 73 in Warrenville. 75 is your Lake Michigan water temperature, winds out of the west at 6. I'm Roger Battish in the WGN Radio Newsroom. This is the stuff that matters on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Matt Bubala here, 720 WGN, 4:39 in the morning. Big O and Max coming up with the morning show at 5 a.m. And then a on and off rainy day for your Saturday. And when is it getting back up to, it feels like 100, Raj? Sunday?
Sunday,
today?
Heat index. Yeah.
Yeah,
inland about 100, maybe about 95 or so along the lakefront.
Yeah.
On Sunday. It's a warm wind, summer.
There were a couple of sticky days this week.
A couple? Jeez.
Yes.
And I've, maybe it's because I'm getting older. But, seriously.
How many things could we say every day?
Maybe it's because I'm getting older. But I'm hating the winters more. And I'm, again, born and bred in Chicago. I'm hating the winters more because it's taking longer to warm up after you come inside. And the summers, even though I loved running outside with 100 degrees, doesn't matter to me as a kid. Now it's like, oi, you know, I look out the window, I check my phone for the temperature, I go, yeah, no, air conditioner goes up a little bit more, you know?
So would you rather it be 20 below right now?
No.
Or 110?
I'd rather it be 110.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh, yes. Are you kidding? It could be 20 below if I'm inside and,
well,
I got
a
warm,
as
a hot toddy.
Rule, which one are you happier with? 20 below or 110?
110.
Yeah, I agree. I have a friend who's going through just some tough family situation stuff right now.
Mm-hmm.
And she was just saying, you know, it's this, sometimes life is just too much. And I said, well, here's how I would look at it, or try to look at it.
Yeah.
It's easier from the outside than in. But,
well, sure, but still.
When I look at how we live in Chicago, and we go through these miserable winters sometimes, just miserable, especially as you get older, right? You know,
right.
As a kid, I loved out skating in Community Park in Munster in the middle of winter when it was 10 below zero out, you know, and we would love it. And now it just, I hate that. And I think that the reason we all live here in Chicago or put up with it is because those miserable, miserable winters make the spring and the summer so thoroughly enjoyable. If we weren't miserable in the winter, when those first days of spring hit, when restaurants started putting their tables back out, we wouldn't live so joyously to see that.
Unfortunately, over the last 10 years or so, especially remember I used to garden a lot, and it's like, what happened to spring? It's like we would get some a couple of warm days, then it would get really hot, then freezing cold again. It would kill off all the plants that had started to grow, and then it would stay cool, not springish, but cooler than spring, and then boom, all of a sudden it's hot in summer. And it's only been over the last 10 years or so. It's like we don't have a spring.
Well, I don't know about
that. But I still like the warmer temperature.
We're still very happy when it comes.
Yeah. Yes.
And that's the point. Yeah. And that's how I kind of look at this weather is like, that's what life is. When you're having really bad times in life, and there's some really awful times generally, it's hard to think about, but there's worse things going on. But also, I try to think of it as, you know, the really, really bad makes us appreciate the really, really good the more. So
now, I don't want to be a Debbie Downer, but you do know the days are getting shorter now.
I'll tell you what, we had baseball practice on Friday night. And usually we can go till, you know, after 8 and still have light.
Right.
And it was 7:20.
It was starting to get dark.
I'm throwing pitches to the kids. I'm like, God, I know there were some clouds in the sky, but I was like, man, I said to some of the parents, gosh, look at, we're already headed towards fall. It's already getting dark out the stocks.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty soon you'll see Halloween stuff in the stores. I know
that's probably already out.
I know. Did you? I threw a text up there. I said after the July 4th, I said Happy July 5th. Back to school supply sales days in the stores, and a bunch of people texted me back, and they said we saw the supplies 2 weeks ago in the stores. It was like before. It was the end of June. They were seeing back to school supplies already.
I totally believe it. I totally believe it. By the way, you were struggling with the late pizza delivery earlier, and you were voicing your concerns about that.
Yeah.
630 asked Roger, "Would you like some cheese with that wine?"
No, but I've got my espresso. Thank you so much.
630 also writes, "To hell with 110. Give me that negative 20. I can always put more on, but can't take enough off."
And you know, if you talk to Nick, Nick is exactly that way. He cannot stand the heat.
Yeah, but I'd rather sweat to death than freeze to death.
But what that texter just said is what Nick says, is that he can put on as much as he wants in the winter to stay warm and then come inside and peel off the different layers and still be warm and not trying to, you know, thaw out from the cold.
In theory, yes, but let's face it. You can't put enough on when it's negative 20. If you got to go walk somewhere, you're uncomfortable. You got to put it all on. You're walking. Your hands are still getting cold. Maybe you're not getting hypothermia or frostbite from it, but you're still cold. Your eyes are freezing shut. Your nose is, you're not covering all these things adequately, no matter what you're putting on. You're still kind of miserable.
Yeah, true. You're still getting cold.
You can get by it, but, you know, I could also stand in the shade when it's 120 and it's not as bad.
And grab a bottle of water.
Or something else.
Well, okay.
All right, quick break, and then our last little bit of news for the day. Have you ever heard of the ghost particle?
I think I have.
Something scientists have been searching for a long time. How they think they have gotten one is pretty fascinating. We'll talk about it after this quick break. 720 WGN. Yeah, a party in the USA.
Is this a dance party all night long
now?
It is,
just really rocking it up.
This is wild. Yeah. I expect the colored lights to start flashing around and everything.
Jeez. Well, we don't have that going yet, but we're working on it. Okay.
Hey, Matt.
Yes.
Real quick, I was talking to Mark, and he said that if we ever wanted to do a show from Spain.
Mark Shipper, our friend who was just on with us.
Yeah, okay. He said have us set up a show, and he said that he would show us around.
Show us around, huh?
Well, we still got to get there. So, unless he's helping with that part.
Just throwing it out there.
773 texts that Hobby Lobby was already stocking Halloween and Christmas.
Look at that. See?
So good for them. We're blowing right past Labor Day, apparently.
That's right.
Labor Day. Where's the Labor Day decorations, huh?
No, the mattress sales.
That's President's Day.
And Memorial Day and Labor Day.
And every single day. 847 says, I grew up in Iowa, but have lived here much longer. I've always said that Illinois doesn't really have a spring. Here we go straight from freezing cold to hot. Iowa/Nebraska always had a true spring, cold winter warming up to milder weather with flowers gently blooming, and then the hot summer.
See?
Thank you, 847. Okay. A single strange particle from deep space may shed light on some of the mysteries of the universe. The tiny, ghost-like subatomic particle was ejected from an incredibly energetic galaxy 4 billion light-years away and could solve the century-old mystery of where cosmic rays come from, as well as providing an entirely new way of looking at the cosmos. The mysterious particle made its way to scientists from the most extreme environments in the universe and will give them an unparalleled look at those intriguing regions. Like the discovery of gravitational waves in 2016, the latest find could give scientists an entirely new way of peering into the infinite depths of space. And just as with the earlier discovery, the new development relied on scientists spotting the tiniest disturbance down on Earth and tracking it to a mysterious black hole billions of light years away. This is from The Independent. The neutrino is the first of its kind detected, and its likely origin was traced to a blazar 4 billion light years away. There, it was thrown out by a galaxy with a vast black hole at its center, flung across the universe as the cosmic consumes matter. Scientists have been mystified by cosmic rays since they were found more than a century ago, pouring down onto Earth. Despite their huge number and intense power, it has been unclear where they come from. The new discovery could finally explain where cosmic rays originate. If correct, the answer could be a fittingly spectacular phenomenon deep in the universe. The neutrinos appear to be spewing out of a fast-spinning supermassive black hole, and the discovery could give us an entirely new way of looking at the universe. The particles might be a, quote, third messenger, carrying energy from elsewhere in the cosmos in addition to light and gravitational waves. If so, the newly observed particle would be an unprecedented way of understanding some of the most intense and mysterious phenomena in the universe. Neutrinos could be doubly helpful because they have no mass and travel in an almost entirely straight line through the universe, which makes them very difficult to detect, but very easy to track as they travel billions of light years. The neutrino, listen to this.
All right.
The neutrino was found on September 22nd by the Ice Cube Observatory, a huge facility a mile beneath the South Pole. A grid of more than 5,000 super-sensitive sensors picked up the characteristic blue Chernikov light emitted as the neutrino interacted with ice. Having almost no mass and passing right through planets, stars, and anything else in its way, the particle traveled in a straight line from its point of origin to Earth. As a result, astronomers were able to track its trajectory back across billions of light years to its probable source. News of the detection sent astronomers into a frenzy as telescopes were pointed in the suggested direction. The search led to a blazar, a special class of galaxy containing a supermassive black hole 4 billion light years away, just to the left of the constellation Orion. The finding was the result of a global effort to track down the source triggered by an automated alert after the intriguing detection at the South Pole. So literally, from what I understand and read in another piece, they found this neutrino in this big block of ice. Which, what doesn't make sense to me is, and I don't understand science clearly, did they find the neutrino or just that the neutrino went through? Because they're saying it passes through stars and planets. Why is it stopping at our block of ice? Did it just get tired?
I don't know, but I wonder what they saw when they put the all the telescopes and everything, trying to see those billions of light years away. I wonder if they saw something like this.
Yes, very. very curious, very interesting. I do so enjoy observing the flora and fauna of that tiny planet.
That's my friend Marvin the Martian.
Marvin the Martian.
Very interesting indeed.
I couldn't resist.
I miss Marvin the Martian. Ron is in Michigan. He's on the phone right now. Hey, Ron, good morning.
Good morning, Matt. Matt, there's something else. I know you've noticed this, but you haven't really noticed it because I didn't tell you. Have you noticed there's no more bugs, dead bugs, on your windows of your cars or on the bumpers? And bugs are vital for our existence on Earth. And I'll tell you something
else. Hold on. What are you talking about? There's no more bugs, dead bugs on my car. You mean like when I'm driving?
Yes, because I live out in the country here, and it's a lot of farm country, and there's virtually no bugs anymore. I mean, I've noticed it, but I read an article about Armageddon for bugs, and in studies, bugs are disappearing, every kind of bug, beetles.
Well, that's very interesting, and I don't know if that's location-based or not, Ron, because my wife insists on turning the front porch lights on every night. And if I have to take the dog out, I hate doing it out the front door because it is inundated with moths and bugs and everything else flying all around. And we just took a family trip. The boys had a baseball tournament in Cooperstown, New York, about a month ago. And when we got to Cooperstown, that last hour, the bugs were hitting the car at a rate that I thought it was raining. I said to Colleen, I said, oh, don't you need the wipers on? Is it raining? And she said, that's not rain. It was when we pulled into a gas station, I was amazed at how our bumper, grill, and windshield were just disgustingly coated with bugs.
Well, Matt, let me refer you to the New York Times Sunday, May 27, 2018, Silence of Bugs. Look that up, please.
Okay.
Because and same thing with butterflies. I mean, butterflies are beautiful and vital. And it's very timely that I came on at this time because the next show that comes on is the Farm Report.
Sure, of course.
And they say it's due mainly to the use and overuse of pesticides on not only on the farm crops, but on lawns as well. And I'm going to tell you, around here where I live, I've tried to cultivate milkweed as much as possible. I mean, I let my lawn kind of go, okay? I'm not a true green guy with the lawn, but
sure.
Because milkweeds are vital to the life cycle of monarch butterflies. But I refer you again to the Silence of Bugs, New York Times. And, I mean, it's worldwide. There's a loss of bugs.
Well, I've certainly heard about the butterflies and the concern about butterflies and the concern about bees, but I have not heard about bugs in general. But thank you so much for the call. I got to take a quick break, and then we got to get to Orion coming up next, and we'll check in with him after this on 720 WGN. 312.